to Reveal is back, and this time it's better than ever. We're giving away over 100,000 prizes, including three new Fiat 500 cars. Buy any slice and peel a tab for your chance to win. Ciao, I'm Dominic Primucci, inviting you to taste the difference.
439-444-PIZZA-NOVA. When searching for a home for Toronto's best sports talk, this is the prime location. Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch. Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right, it is Friday. This is Primetime Sports. Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch, joined by, in studio, by a familiar voice. I guess a familiar face at times, too. Ren Lavoie of TVA Sports.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. Thanks for having me, and I love The Cure, so you just got
there
me.
There you go. Well, that's, you've been on the stage. I think you were in here with me in person.
Yeah.
It was a couple of years ago.
Oh, that's close to 5 years ago, actually. Yeah.
You're in town, of course, because the Canadiens are playing the Maple Leafs. And we will have our Friday roundtable, by the way. Davidi and Amber will join us at 5 o'clock. The Canadiens got their season started in Carolina last night, lost in a shootout. They will play Toronto tomorrow night at Scotiabank Arena. The Leafs will play Columbus tonight in Columbus. So, Ren, what are the Montreal Canadiens this year?
They're fast. They were fast last year, but the difference now is it's the younger core that's coming in. And I have to call it the younger core because this is the future of that franchise. Ryan Poehling is not with the team right now. He's going to play his first game tonight in Laval. Remember, he played the last game versus the Toronto Maple Leafs last year at the Bell Centre, scored three goals, and one in a shootout. So 4 goals total. He was obviously the first star of that night. What happened with Ryan Poehling is this. He got a concussion in Bathurst, and so he missed close to a week. And so that's they used the fact that he had a concussion not to start him.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, for me, he's the DNA of what the Montreal Canadiens are going to look like in the future. And some people are saying, you know what, he's more a third line, centerman. He's not. You're going to see him, I'm pretty sure, by the end of this season, playing maybe on the second line, maybe on the first line. We'll see. Obviously, hopefully there won't be any injuries, but you know how it works. There's always some injured players. But the fact that they have younger players coming in, they're not only in the system, they're knocking on the door. They're playing for the Montreal Canadiens, like a guy like Nick Suzuki. This is the future. It's a bright future, and it's about time. Let's be honest.
Mm. You know, one of the things that's interesting about the Canadiens this year is if you look at preseason projections from writers and broadcasters who cover the sport on a daily basis, there's not they're the one team where there's not sort of a uniform of opinion. There are people who believe it's a playoff team, maybe sixth or seventh team.
Totally.
Jeff and I were talking about this. Mm-hmm. Then there are others who are like still a little bit too young and not ready. Where do you – I like them. I think they're going to sneak in for a playoff spot, but I can certainly understand the logic of saying they're probably a year away. Where do you see them in relation to the rest of the conference?
You know what? It's so complicated. Let's be honest. Okay, they have Carey Price. This is obviously their best player. It helps because without Carey Price, I don't think – you wouldn't ask that question, right?
We would
have said, it's not going to be their year. We're going to wait and see what's going to happen. But let's be honest, with parity now in the NHL, it's kind of scary. It is scary, okay? Mm-hmm. Because we know 100% for sure that Ottawa is not going to make the playoffs, okay? We know, is it 100%? Let's say 99% that Tampa is going to make the playoffs. But after that, I'm looking at Toronto, great team. I love to watch the Maple Leafs. But let's say their number one goaltenders get injured. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen next, okay? This is a problem for a lot of teams. Parity in the league is making, I think, prediction a little – we look like fools. Mm-hmm. Last year, and that's why this year I decided not to make any prediction, and I'm going to tell you why. I put the St. Louis Blues last year, like right now, a year ago, last in their division. I was the smartest guy, I guess, in the world January 1st.
You were.
But
you
I
were
looked like a genius. But on June 1st, I mean, I looked like the stupidest guy on earth, okay? And when they raised that Stanley Cup, and I look at that like 10 days ago, I look at my prediction from last year, and I looked at the St. Louis Blues, and I was like, my God. I mean, how do you want to predict anything in this league anymore? Mm-hmm. It's like Vegas is going to make the playoffs. We know that, right? So there's maybe four teams, two probably in the East, two probably in the Western Conference, that you can say for sure they're going to make it.
Right.
Otherwise, I mean, you can flip a coin and maybe you're going to look, you know, you're not going to look stupid by just flipping a coin. That's the problem. So that's what I see with the Montreal Canadiens right now. A team that they're better than last year. One of the reasons why, I think, is a guy like Kincaid as their backup compared to Niemi. That's going to help. Mm-hmm. Shea Weber is there, right? Since he was there playing last night. We're not going to wait till the end of November to see him. That's huge. And after that, the young core, the young skaters, the Jonathan Drouin of this world there. Jonathan played so great last night with Kotkaniemi. He had, guys, if you watch him on.
That guy's going to be great.
He's going to be great, yeah. But his training camp was really difficult. And
really?
I could use other words easily, okay? It was a tough
Drouin
training.
Kotkaniemi.
Yeah, Kotkaniemi. And Drouin, like media in Montreal were all over him,
right?
Okay? But the way he played last night, I think.
Yeah.
It's not going to be an issue, but same with Kotkaniemi because his training camp, it was really, really hard for him.
How so?
I think it was it was not physical, it was mental. Like it feels like he wanted to do so much again. A little bit like his rookie camp last year. He didn't play well at all. But after that, when the regular training camp started, he was way better. Suddenly this year, we're seeing the same thing, just a different month. He's playing really well in October, not in September. Hmm. It's weird. But you have to appreciate the way that he played last night. He was not making a lot of mistakes, not scared to play with the puck, making some plays. And Drouin and Armia, I really thought that line would have made the difference, not in a good way last night, in a bad way, but au contraire, like they say in French, they did their job, and people were really surprised by the way they were playing.
You know, I look at this team, and there's a lot of depth. There's a lot of skill depth. Yep. But, Ren, I think most people say they're still kind of missing that guy, right? Do you think they're missing that? You know, the good thing for Montreal is you've got enough good players here that if you could add that guy, that dominating forward.
Austin
Matthews would be good. But you know what I mean? That's the only thing I think separating this team.
Because yeah.
If you add that guy all of a sudden, now you got Carey Price.
Oh, yeah.
Now you got Shea Weber leading the defense. And you've got three lines that are unbelievably quick.
Can that guy be as tall as me, a 5'8" type of guy? Caulfield was their first round pick.
Yeah, you think he's
like the way he conduct himself in the preseason in the NCAA was like amazing to watch. And the Canadiens think that if he's having a good season, when he'll be out of the playoffs, that if he's playing at a really good level, that there's a good chance that by March, he's going to be here with the Montreal Canadiens. He's playing it with Wisconsin. It's not it's not supposed to be a team that's going to have a long playoff run. So that helps for the Montreal Canadiens. Caulfield, I think they sent him in a way to the NCAA, say, go play, go score some goals. But maybe we're going to see you soon. And if he's playing at the level that he's supposed to, there's a chance he's going to be with the team by the end of the season. Hmm. I'm telling you. So is he going to be an Austin Matthews type of player? Those are two different type of animals right here. But maybe the goal scorer that everybody's waiting for,
right?
He's already here. Not in Montreal, but in the system, which is great. And if you look at the way a guy not like Nick Suzuki is going to play by the end of the season, Ryan Poehling's going to be there. Guys, it's going to be fun to watch.
One of the guys that's always kind of tough to figure out, because he's had pretty good highs, but he's also sort of been invisible sometimes, is Thomas Tatar, who seems like he's, but it feels like he's sort of found a second life.
Yeah.
In Montreal, from your perspective of watching him.
Yeah.
What do you think this guy's going to be this year?
Well, you know what? I think what happened with Vegas was a slap in the face.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. Okay, you're being traded from Detroit, the team that drafted you. First of all, probably was a shock for him. For a first rounder, a second rounder, and a third rounder.
Mm-hmm.
And how many games did he play? You're not even playing. Maybe he played one game or two in the Stanley Cup final, something like that. I mean, everybody else was playing, not him. And it was a slap in the face. I think that some people are saying that in the Max Pacioretty trade that he's a throw-in. Listen, maybe he's a throw-in, but I feel like he wanted to show the rest of the world that he's not that type of player, that he's way better than that. He's a skilled guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's amazing to watch. And he had a good preseason. I think he played well last night again. He experienced the fact that he's playing in Montreal, which is a unique city in the league, helps. He's not scared of, talking to media, not scared of any ice rain or something like that. I'm pretty sure that he had that when he was a younger player, mm-hmm. too. So, no, and he's obviously a great guy that everybody, I'm telling you, everybody likes in that dressing room. And just the way he conducts himself, like bringing, let's say, coffee after a practice to his line mates and stuff like that. It's details all the time, mm-hmm. but to be sure that everybody's okay, he's that type of player.
It sounds like this is, just from some of the reading and some of the stuff I've seen on TV, it sounds around like this is a really good dressing room.
It is.
In Montreal. It sounds like it's really, really tight knit. What brought about that change? Was it Max Domi or the younger guys? What brought about that change?
Shea Weber, Man Mountain. Yeah. Remember who said that?
Yeah. Huh? Okay.
So, and I think that Mike Babcock, when he said that, we were in Ottawa during the preseason of the World Cup, and there was a question about Shea Weber, who's just been traded mm-hmm. for PK Subban at the time. And Mike talked about the culture, what he's going to bring, what he's bringing to his team. And so I think that World Cup was great for me and for a lot of people in the Montreal Canadiens organization, because first of all, you had that Mike Babcock quote, which helps, mm-hmm. let's be honest. Second of all, you have discussions with all the best players in the world. Okay, for Team Canada, you have a guy like Sidney Crosby. So I had a discussion, it was not on record, but I can use mm-hmm. whatever that discussion was, because I think it's going to show what Shea Weber is. And I asked Sidney, how's Shea? What type of man he is, mm-hmm. we're all looking up to him. Mm-hmm. We're all looking at him. He's the one. He wasn't the one with the captain
right.
on his jersey, right? But he was the captain of that team. And nothing against Sidney Crosby. It's Sidney Crosby saying that. It's mm-hmm. not me. So I think Shea is that type of guy. So the preseason ended on Saturday. On Sunday, he organized a baseball game between all his teammates. After that game, they went all to his place to watch football, spend the day all together. And I asked him about that game and that day and the fact that they watched football after. And he said, you know what? This is the greatest day. Was it? Like, it was mm-hmm. beautiful in Montreal. And for him, it was the perfect day. So playing baseball with his teammates, having fun, making sure that everybody's going to have a barbecue after mm-hmm. watching the NFL games, that's a leader. That's the guy, and everybody was there. Even the players that were put on waivers, let's say on Sunday,
right.
they were there. Hmm. They were, like, Chaludon was there. Ryan Poehling was there. Because, yes, it's a 23-man roster, but there's 25, 26 players probably who should have made that team, right?
Yeah.
So he's that type of man. And Marc Bergevin, I think, said something really important here. He said that when kids like Suzuki or Poehling or Cal Fleury, he said to them, you're making the team, he said, if you have a problem, go talk to Shea.
Hmm.
Let's imagine the GM saying to a kid, if you have a problem, go talk to Shea.
Because we were talking about the importance of, and there I think you have it. I mean, you asked the question of John Tavares and Brian Burke and even Wendell Clark, Richard, about the importance of a captain in 2019. One of the things we talked about, right? The guy who's the conduit.
Yeah.
But that's something if the general manager says, if you have an issue, go see this guy.
I'm a one question questioner. but no, you actually can get a lot of insight from there. I understand, and obviously Jeff would know this too, having worked there for so many years. I get the pressure of being a Canadian. I understand expectations, just like the Yankees are always going to be sky high.
Which is great.
But realistically, what do you think the fan base expects from this team? Like, do they expect a playoff? I don't think they expect a cup win, but do you think the fan base or is the conversation locally like, we are going to make the playoffs this
year? That's a great question, okay? I don't know exactly what the fan base want, but I'm going to tell you this, okay? So every preseason, I'm bringing my oldest daughter to see one game, right? So it was Ottawa, Montreal. Last Saturday, I was in shock by the atmosphere there. And I couldn't believe it. It's a preseason game. It felt like a regular season game. And I'm not talking during the game, even before the game. I couldn't believe it was a sellout. Every seat was occupied, okay? So I was leaving, and I saw somebody working for the Canadiens. I said, is it just me? But I feel like, wow, tonight was unique. We're in preseason. It's the last game. The Ottawa Senators on the other side. It's not supposed to be that way. He said, Renaud, I don't know if you were there. I wasn't there for that game, but they did a red versus white game. That was kind of a type of free game. You can come in. You were paying $5 to see that scrimmage, okay? He said, Renaud, we had to refuse people at the door. Mm-hmm. There was some kids crying because they couldn't come in, right? And I said, so what does that tell you? He said, there's a different vibe. There's a different vibe right now with that franchise. I'm not talking about the media. Mm-hmm. Media is not really reporting that.
Right.
It's okay. But the fan base, their hook, feels like the fact that the young players are coming in is great. And if I can use a parallel to what's going on here in Toronto, but with baseball, because we're broadcasting at TVA Sports, the Blue Jays game. So, and I was with my boss, and we were talking about ratings, and he said, Renaud, we don't know exactly why right now, but the Blue Jays rating are huge. And I'm like, what?
In Quebec, yeah.
But they weren't even close to make the playoffs since day one,
right?
But we're talking about ratings in August and September. We're not talking about ratings in April or May. And thinking about it, and we all said the same thing, the young players coming in. Vladimir, Biggio, Bo. Who doesn't love Bo?
Could you imagine? I had someone when he was playing in Montreal. I had someone in the Montreal media who I'm not going to identify said to me, Bo Bichette would be the mayor of Crescent Street if he lived in Montreal.
Oh, totally. I mean, obviously, I was there when he played his first game at the Big O preseason. That was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
The guy's name is Bo Bichette. You're going to...
In Montreal, you're going to do well.
Yeah, you're going to do well. And I like the way he played. Obviously, they did the right thing playing him in the minors. I think he had a great year this season in Toronto. But I think the Blue Jays fans like their team, not because they're going to make the playoffs maybe next year, but just because the future is bright. That's what they want to see. And it's exactly the same thing with the Montreal Canadiens. Hey, there's a kid called Primo playing for the Rocket. He's Keith Primo's son, okay? Caden Primo. You're going to hear a lot about that guy. It's a 7th-round pick. But the way he played during half a game in Montreal, people were so impressed. And I saw Keith after the game and wearing, can you imagine, a Montreal Canadiens...
Keith Primo?
Yeah. And I was like, are you okay with that? And he's like, oh, I feel good wearing that jersey. And I said, perfect. But we're going to hear about that kid in a few years. So the future is bright. That's what people wants to see, I think.
It seems to me, Ren, that what's happened here is Carey Price is a separate case, but you almost get the sense that by trading PK Subban, it's almost like everything's been... been erased from the recent memory bank. Yep. And it's almost like this is a very new team. And I mean that I don't mean that in a bad way. Every franchise has to go through that.
But we're living in that type of era, Jeff. You and I weren't born yesterday.
No.
Life was different.
Well, you were, but I wasn't.
I wasn't. And life, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but way different even 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I mean, everything is quick. And it's so quick that we don't sometimes realize what really is going on. Like I mentioned, the media are not reporting the fact that there's something unique with the Montreal Canadiens right now because fans are hooked. They're hooked to the team because of the younger players. Because we're all maybe thinking, older people's, about P.K. Subban, that was 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, or Max Patch already. You know what I mean? So we're thinking about the past, but I think people they don't care. They don't care about the past. They're thinking about right now.
The Canadiens will play the Leafs tomorrow night. We have Ren Lavoie of KVS Sports in studio, and we'll get a look, an outside the Toronto bubble look at the Toronto Maple Leafs when we come back. It's primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand, absolutely free. Now back to primetime sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to primetime sports. It's the penultimate Friday roundtable. We have David Amber and Shai Davidi.
Good group for the penultimate edition.
Ren Lavoie joining us in studio. Now, there will be roundtables, though, because we're going to 2 to 5 the week after next.
Right.
And we are going to have roundtables. Roundtables are not dying. We'll have a round, but we're going to do it a little differently. We're going to have a roundtable on Monday and a roundtable on Friday.
I'm excited about that.
Of an hour.
I like
each.
That. So that's actually an additional day, but no longer the 2 hours, which I think's going to be okay still, don't you?
It'll be fine.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. We'll make it work.
No, I'm excited. That's one thing I am really happy that... that will continue in terms of the tradition of primetime sports. Because as a listener, that was always my favorite thing to listen to.
Well, and it's great for the host because...
Sit back.
You got three other people talking.
Go downstairs.
It's like a long weekend.
If you're a smoker, go downstairs for a smoke. You'd be okay.
Yeah, there have been people in here who've done that, isn't there? Ren Lavoie of TVS Sports joining us in studio. Ren Lavoie is between the benches for TVS Sports and their Habs coverage. And I wanted before we get to the Leafs, you talked about how much you like being between the benches in Toronto.
It's unique.
Why? Why Toronto?
Okay. So the first time my boss said you're going to be between the bench, we did because it was the first time that TVA had the broadcasting right. So we did a preseason game just for fun. It wasn't air, just a practice. It was Detroit playing the Maple Leafs. By the way, Mike Babcock was coaching the Red Wings, obviously.
Right.
But when I arrived to between the bench at the ACC at the time, I looked at it and I said, how stupid am I to say yes to that? Because it's great. But at the time, it's the only place in the league where you can really be hit hard because there's no space. There's a window glass just behind you, and there's two people sitting right there, okay? So there's not a lot of place you can move. And since last year or maybe 2 years ago, Sportsnet, on Saturday night, they have a camera there, a cameraman, which is okay. But for me, you always need to look at the puck. Wherever you are in the league, between the bench, your eyes are always on the puck because it's really dangerous. If you're not looking at the puck, you can hurt yourself badly. But if you have a cameraman beside you, it's tough to move.
Sure.
Right? He's bigger than a human being. So that doesn't help. The first time I was there, Canadiens, obviously, versus the Toronto Maple Leafs, P.A. Pirano hit me with his own stick right on my shoulder. that was game one. And I said to myself, oh boy,
yeah,
here we go.
What did I sign up for?
Yeah, but
what
it's the greatest place, obviously, to watch a hockey game. It's unique.
One of the things that is interesting to me about that position, and I've heard P.M. McGuire and some of these other guys who've had that in the States talk about, is they have to navigate between what they hear and what they'll ultimately report.
Totally.
And I wonder how you navigate that, because as a reporter, obviously, your instinct is you want to let the audience know everything.
Yeah.
At the same time, the reality is that the league and the teams are allowing you and affording you this position.
Yeah.
So you got to navigate this world. So for you, how do you navigate that?
So I think for the players and obviously the teams and the league, it's more about injuries. So if it's something that we didn't see on TV, you just don't report it.
Okay.
Like, you can't say it's an upper body type of injury. You can't say, I don't think it's that major, or it looks really important. You can't say something like that. But if it's a slash to the hand, you have no choice. You can't say that's an upper body injury. Obviously, the replay is saying that it's a slash to the hand. You're calling it like it is, right? But the discussions between the players, you know, I don't go there. Some, yes. Like, there was a game, Montreal playing at home versus the Ottawa Senators. That was in December, maybe 2 weeks before December. And I don't remember which Ottawa player scored on Carey Price to start the game. So, and it was a fluke. Like, it was not supposed to go in. So Carey Price is coming back in front of me, which is obviously close to the Ottawa Senators bench, and he's looking at the Ottawa Senators bench, and the players are laughing. And he's looking at the player who scored that goal and said, Merry Christmas. That was your gift. I reported it because that was great.
That's funny. Yeah, nobody's going to take offense.
Exactly. And he allowed one goal that night. 26 shots, I remember, only one goal. That was the goal. He was not happy about that goal. That's the year that he won all, obviously, the trophies.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Did you hear it all from the Canadians about, because that's what I was going to get to, is if you, like, I am sure there are times when people are chippy, yelling at each other, cursing. So you got to pick your spot. But in that situation, did either Price or the Canadians have any issue with you reporting?
Never. Because one thing that I obviously, there's some things on the benches that are being said between even teammates. Okay. I could have easily create once or twice a major story, but don't go there. I mean, you need to understand what it is. It's hockey. Eat up the moment. The emotions are high. You want to win. Something happens. And obviously, some people can be upset with a play that the teammates did. And it's all right. I prefer that the players vent it. Like, and I remember one of that player that was being beat up by another teammate verbally. He looked at me. I'm between the bench. Look at me. Can you believe what he just said to me? Can you believe that guy? I can't believe that he said something. He was like pissed, not happy. But I decide obviously not to say a thing, because if I said something like this, if I reported what happened, probably would have been my last day between the benches. You need to be smarter than that, right?
Who's the best talker? I mean, when you, like, the guy, if the guy standing beside you, I'm sorry, you're sitting beside you, if it's a goaltender, who's the guy that you have really good discussions with? I'm not saying just a good guy to talk to.
Between the benches or all around?
Just between the benches. Like, during a game, are there guys that will chat with you?
Yeah, it happens, but it's because, like, I remember David Darnay asking me if, I don't know which team won, to make sure that or lost that game, to make sure that the games were in, something like that. Or a question about, do you think it's a goal? We're going to do a video review. Is it a goal? You have the monitor in front of you to review what happened. So the players are asking, when they're talking to you, when you're looking at a player talking to you, it's because they want an answer to just what happened.
Yeah.
Sidney Crosby's great. Sidney Crosby, great. I mean, coming back to the bench, not being necessarily happy with a non-call on the ice or a call on the ice, something like that. But he's always looking at you, and he's like, you think it's a penalty? Am I wrong? Like, should I have said something to the referee? There are some players like that. But I'm telling you, what changed, I think, is now they're all business. All business, really? All the time. Like, Max Pacioretty, I said to him, because we had a conversation about actually the between the bench, and when I arrived there 5 years ago, I expected a lot of chit-chat between the two
teams.
Yeah,
that's, you would think, yeah.
And what Max told me, he said, you know, Renaud, we realize over the years that if you're you're starting, let's say, a fight, not a physical fight, but a verbal fight with another player, it's going to hurt your team at the end because they're going to score a goal. Maybe it's going to pump up the other bench, mm-hmm. right? So there's less and less. One guy that was great last year was Max Domi. Here in Toronto, it was, wow, was great. But no, you still hear some stuff. I feel like the rivalry between the Canes and the Maple Leafs, with the fact that Max Domi is now on that team, mm-hmm. is way better than it was maybe a year ago or 2 years ago.
I was going to say, because now it's, you know, Toronto is still, somebody said last night, Toronto's actually the second or third youngest team in the league,
yeah.
which I didn't have any idea, but they're the second or third youngest team. It's funny, these are two young teams, and you can almost see them kind of growing up together.
Yeah.
And yeah, the Leafs probably have the edge right now because they have Tavares and they have Matthews. But you almost get the sense, Ren, that there is something under the surface that this rivalry may come back.
Oh, yeah, it will. It will. Because, you know, there is some really good players on both sides. Obviously, you have Austin Matthews, which I think is, you know, I talked to Matt Dumba a month ago in Chicago, when all the stars players in the league were there for a car wash. That's what we call interviews with those players. And I asked him, I had a survey to make, who's going to be the best player in the league. And he said, it's going to be Austin Matthews. Matt Dumba is not an American. Mm-hmm. He's a Canadian. He doesn't have to say that about Austin Matthews if he doesn't believe so. And he's right. So, but the fact that Austin is there, I don't think that Austin is the type of player that players don't really want to go under his skin, right? If he's sleeping one night, let him sleep. Like, you don't want to wake up that bear. But the fact that, you know, we're talking now, it's all business. The reality is you have a guy like Max Domi. And, you know, he was with Tim and Sid earlier this mm-hmm. summer. I don't know how in Toronto that what he said was taken when he said that Montreal, you actually said Montreal is better than Toronto in a way to play hockey, something like that. And so when we were in Montreal, we were a little shocked because we know the history, mm-hmm. right? His godfather is Matt Sundin.
Yeah.
His father is Ty Domi. So you didn't expect Max to say something like that. People in Montreal obviously really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. But so I feel like characters like people like Max are going to steer the pot when it's time to steer the pot. I'm a little sad that Andrew Shaw is gone, though. Because Andrew Shaw had some great quotes during TV timeouts, looking to, let's say, JT Brown and say, nobody likes you on your team. And I was like, and sadly, Brown had nothing to say. Maybe maybe he thought he was right, that Andrew was right.
It could be. And, well, of course, Nazem Kadri's not there. So I don't know who will fill the agitator role for Toronto.
Nazem... Last year, there was not a lot of action around him with mm-hmm. Montreal. Maybe 3 years ago, but no. Because he scored some big goals versus the Montreal Canadiens, right? You don't want to... You need to be careful here with what you're doing. And I think the coaches are asking the players to focus on, you know, between the whistles, not after. But rivalries are rivalries, and I think Toronto and Montreal is getting there.
The thing with the Maple Leafs that has become like a conversation throughout the NHL is, can you build a team with, you know, four players taking that much sort of money when it comes to the salary cap? And then the other sort of part of that equation is Kyle Dubas has clearly built a team, sort of a skill team, as opposed to this traditional, you know, brawn team that's built for the Stanley Cup postseason. From your perspective, where do you stand in that philosophy? I mean, if the Leafs end up winning, I think you will see the league try to copycat Kyle. If they don't,
oh yeah, for sure,
then he's going to be basically, you'll go back to the old school of, you can't win with a team sort of as Kyle constructed.
Everybody's watching. Everybody's interested. Believe me, everybody around the league. Because if it happens the way it's supposed to, the Toronto Maple Leafs are going to win a Stanley Cup soon.
Right.
Is it this season? Is going to be in 2 or 3 years? We don't know, but they should. They're built for that. Okay. Everybody's looking. I think that the biggest problem here is the salary cap, because normally today the salary cap, when they signed that CBA in early January 13, when you look at projection, cap was not at 81.5 in 2019. It was closer to 90 million. Okay. That's the problem here. And that's, I really do believe, what hurts the Chicago Blackhawks, because they spent all that money three, 4 years ago, thinking that the cap would easily be at 90. Mm-hmm. It's not true. It's not getting there. So everybody's watching the Maple Leafs. I think they have the luxury of having great players. It's a luxury. The Pittsburgh Penguins had that luxury. The Chicago Blackhawks had that luxury. Now it's the Tampa Bay Lightning in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Toronto Maple Leafs. That's the reality. Everybody envy the Toronto Maple Leafs and Kyle Dubas. Everybody wants to be in his shoes. Let's be honest here. You want to have those kids in your lineup. And after that, if you have to make a trade to get the defenseman that we're all asking for, blah, 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 you're gonna have the assets to do it if you want to take that road. But I think it's a unique situation here in Toronto, but it's not a bad situation. I let's see how it's gonna, at the end of this season, I think we'll have a good sense of, is it really working or not?
Mm-hmm.
That's my feeling.
Yeah, and I mean, at some point, decisions are going to have to be made as well about Morgan Riley. You're going to have to be made about Frederick Anderson. Those guys are going to have to get paid more than they're paid now.
That's why I believe that their window, in a way, is right now.
I agree with you.
Absolutely.
It's right now. It's sad to say, but you'll have to beat the Lightning at one point in the playoffs. It's going to happen. You'll have to win versus that team. And after that, you'll have to play Wes. And I know, and I don't know if you watched that game between, San Jose and Vegas, first night on Wednesday, was crazy, because we did at TVA, we did the Leafs game, and after that, we did that game in Vegas. Those are two different leagues. They're not playing the same way.
Right.
They were killing each other in the West. Here in the East, it was all about skills, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was.
Which is the way it used to be flipped the other way.
The West
was the skilled. The Western Conference was the skill league, and the East was the...
But I can't believe it. I was texting with Marcia so yesterday, and I said, Joe, it's scary to watch you guys play. And we're not used to it. In baseball, it's two different leagues, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a reason why you have a DH.
Right.
I mean, the rules are the rules. But it's the same rules for everybody in hockey, but it's totally different. The Western Conference is way more physical.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I just want to ask one very quick question of you about Mike Babcock. He's under a lot of pressure here in the city, obviously. Do people around the game view him as being under pressure too?
Yeah.
Or is that just a Toronto thing?
No, it's not. I think when you're on top, okay, when you're on top, because I do believe today Mike Babcock is a great coach. He was last year. He still is. I feel like when you're on top, you're always, somebody's looking at you and is going to say things about you it's always going to be negative. It's tough to have positive about one coach or one person who's on top. Let's be honest here. It's easy to look at other coaches around the league and say, oh, this guy's a great guy, but it's a different animal playing or coaching in Toronto. Mm-hmm. You have to be ready. And I think Mike, personally, I think is the right fit today for that team. No doubt about that. I'm a little disappointed to hear some players that played with the Leafs last season saying they didn't want to say much, but it's kind of, I didn't really like my time in Toronto. Come on, man. What are you saying? Like, let the coach and do your job. That's it. No?
Ren, it was great of you to join us.
Thanks for having
Thanks
me.
So much.
It's always fun to be in Toronto.
Ren LeVar. The Friday Roundtable assembles Davidi, Amber, Deitch, and Blair. It's primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Sportsnet, Sportsnet Now, and starting Monday, October 14th, Tim and Sid are back on the radio.
Entertaining the masses, sports entertainment.
5 to 7 every weekday on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right, welcome to the Friday Roundtable. It's Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch, Shai Davidi, David Amber. What were you pointing at, Davidi?
Pointing you at the latest baseball scores.
Cardinals 4.
Braves 1, Cardinals nothing. Bottom first.
Or Braves 1, Cardinals nothing.
Just underway.
All right. I don't know. You caught me off guard.
Didn't mean to. I thought you were curious about the scores, so I thought I'd give you easy access to them.
Well, I was watching the Astros-Rays game. Very disappointing. Very disappointing game so far. This is, by the way, the penultimate roundtable. You know that Tim and Sid will be taking over the 5 to 7 time slot a week from Monday. We will be going from 2 to 5. I shouldn't say it's a penultimate roundtable in this format, but effect of our 2 to 5 shift, we're going to do an hour roundtable on Monday and an hour roundtable on Friday. So just so you know, when I say it's the penultimate roundtable, I mean it's the penultimate roundtable in this current.
David Amber, by the way, will now be one of our lead-ins. It's exciting for me, right? Hockey Central.
On Wednesdays.
On Wednesdays.
That's right.
Wednesdays, yes.
All right. Big ratings day for us now.
Well,
with a big lead-in.
Yeah. Start from zero, work your way up.
It must be. I see that Brian Burke stayed in for 2 hours today.
Yeah. Whoa,
Hockey
really?
Central. Yeah. He might have been contractually obligated. I
don't know. Nice.
Burke's had a lot to say.
It was good. That was actually really, he's got some good stories.
He's great on radio.
He's pumped right now. The start of the season.
I know.
Like his reaction yesterday when I asked about, is there a difference between being captain of the Islanders and captain of the Leafs? And he dropped a word in the air.
Did he manage to keep his hands off your neck when he said that?
No, he was laughing. It was all good humor. That was just before we started talking about soccer, and he made the comment about he'd rather have hot poker shoved in his eyes than watch a soccer.
And then he came up with what was the word again?
Dinosaurian. I don't have my senior moments, but I have my dinosaurian moments.
Which I feel like he created a word, basically. I mean, maybe it is in the dictionary somewhere, but I'm going to steal that. Dinosaurian is kind of that's a cool little shot, you know, if you want to take it, somebody who's a little out of touch.
Yeah, I think it's a great word. Yeah.
Baseball can use that to anyone who still cares about ERA or batting average.
That's true.
Very true. You're right.
Absolutely. The Leafs, by the way, get back on the ice tonight against the Columbus Blue Jackets. We already know Jason Spezza will be in the lineup. We already know that Freddie Anderson will start. We do not know who will play tomorrow night when the Montreal Canadiens are in town. And, I mean, sort of the whole idea of load management for Freddie Anderson is one of the stories I wanted to talk about out of the gate. But we got to talk about the story that galvanized, that occupied the city for a month, the naming of the Leafs captain, which was, Davidi's just looking at me. Forget that you're a baseball writer for a minute. Just to work with me on this. John Tavares named the 25th captain in Leafs history before the home opener. Mr. Amber, did you have a tear in your eye when he came out?
I'm happy for him. I didn't have a tear in my eye, but I know it was kind of the opposite. The pageantry wasn't exactly there, and because everyone had speculated it was going to be the case for, a good week and a half, it wasn't. Had it not been him, it would have been shocking, right?
Mm-hmm.
The safe guy. I mean, this guy is the consummate professional on the ice, off the ice. They liken him to Kawhi Leonard and his workmanlike approach to everything. You're never going to have an issue with him that you have to be
concerned. He does not have an Uncle Dennis, though, I hope.
let's hope he's sticking around.
He doesn't have it out in his contract.
Yeah, so that's 6 years he should
good
be
point.
Here. It was a safe pick, and by a lot of accounts, maybe the smart pick and the prudent pick. And what I mean by that is, why burden these young guys with the responsibility that goes on to being the captain of the Maple Leafs? Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner. Morgan Rielly, I think, would have been a good choice. And we talked about it on air, Jeff, where I actually said I would have maybe had him as my choice for a number of different reasons. But Tavares, to me, is a very safe pick. And you can let Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner go out there and just perform without being, having to be the liaison between the coach and the other players, without having to be the liaison between essentially the media and the players, which isn't a bad thing.
No, you know, and Richard, one of the things that I hadn't thought about this, but was when mentioned to me the other day about naming John Tavares captain. He's here for a long time. Like, his contract runs. He's got another
6 years.
6 years. Morgan Riley is not, you hope he's here for 6 years, but Morgan Riley at some point is going to have three more years. So this person said, look, part of the thinking on the part of the Leafs is maybe Morgan Riley is a candidate, but, you know, if you've got to negotiate a new contract with the guy and he's wearing the C, I mean, that just complicates things. Whereas you know that you've addressed the issue with John Tavares. John Tavares may blow his knee out at some point. He may miss 80 games the rest of his Leafs career. He's going to be the same guy. Like, he will be your captain until the day he retires. So I think that probably went into the thought process too, because you don't know if Austin Matthews, Richard, or Morgan Riley are necessarily going
to
be around.
Well, to me, there's a larger debate. You know, David, I'd love to get your take on this. Is sort of like the importance of a captain in 2019. But
you were going to ask that question of everybody.
I love that question.
But it's a good question. Yeah.
They're fortunate. They were fortunate to have two, I would almost say, unassailable choices. They couldn't go wrong with Riley or John Tavares. And, you know, at a certain point, obviously, before Arizona, I'm sure there was consideration about Austin Matthews, just given he's probably the best player on the team, at least in terms of skill set and stuff like that. So I don't think they could have gone wrong. The thing I'd be interested, David, in your case is, do you give any credence to, like, the fact is, like, John is a better player than Morgan Riley, at least sort of conventionally. And if you can get your best player to also be your captain, is there, you know what I mean? Is there value there in terms of, like, not only do you have a guy in the dressing room people listen to, but his numbers on the ice also back up his place on the team?
Yeah, I might actually make an argument that when you say John Tavares is a better player than Morgan Riley. I mean, I think if Morgan Riley goes down with a knee-ending injury, it almost might be more devastating than John Tavares.
That's fair.
Based on the depth.
Well, then Freddie Anderson should be the captain.
We've tried that before in Vancouver. Listen, I think there is an importance to the position, and it's to read the pulse of the team, to say to Mike Babcock, hey, we just played Thursday, we're going to play Saturday. Let's not practice on Sunday. I read the players. I'm with the players. I know how we feel.
Right.
There has to be a trust level there. Yeah, it's a bit more pomp and circumstance. I don't think it's going to make the difference between, you know, winning a championship and not winning a championship. But it is a role that you need someone that has the trust of management, but also has the trust of the locker room. It has the ear and respect of the locker room. And I think Tavares, as well as Riley, had that. To say it needs to be with the best player, then no. I honestly then think it should have been with Austin Matthews, because this is a guy, you could argue, he's one of the best players in the league.
Yeah.
I mean, he's in that conversation.
I agree.
This is a guy I think is... You know, if he stays healthy, he will score 50 goals this year. And you could make that argument. He's right there with the McDavids, the Crosbys, et cetera.
Let me ask you this. We all here, I mean, we've all talked about Shai. You probably haven't. We've spent a great deal of time talking about the Leafs captaincy. And it's not just because it's an easy topic for sports talk radio. We've talked about it, and we've always couched it in terms of, well, it's really not that big a deal, and we really shouldn't be talking about it, but let's talk about it. But every player you talk to says, no, it's a big deal. Yeah. I mean, you know, anybody around here who played, you know, it's not really that important in 2019. They go, yeah, it is important in 2019. Why is it Shai? Why does it remain such an important, do you think, it remains such an important thing for hockey players? Because other sports, it's not really.
No, it's not in other sports. And to me, I have trouble understanding why it's so important. And what I'm really curious, and Dave, maybe you can answer this. Now that John Tavares has the C, aside from the letter being stitched on his jersey, is anything markedly different in that room? Like, is something work differently now that he's officially the captain compared to where it was last year? Because if there was, you know, you mentioned guys being tired after a game and maybe needing a blow at practice, would John Tavares not have gone up to Mike Babcock last year in the same way that he would now? Have the roles on the team changed in any significant way? And I don't really think that they have, which is why I don't understand. I mean, I understand from a global perspective why this is a big deal and the history and the tradition and all that other stuff. But in terms of the way it works in that room, I don't know if there's anything different today compared to a week ago.
And I just wanted to interject too, because someone pointed out to me on Twitter the other day, and I thought it was really perceptive and I should have mentioned it. It's also a big deal in soccer. Like, you would be surprised. You listen to talk shows in the UK. The identity of the captain of the English team, English national team, people get into fist fights about it because now you're talking about club. So it's, but it is a big deal there. It's the only other sport I can think of, David.
Well, we all knew Derek Jeter. You know, you're a baseball guy. We all knew Derek Jeter was a captain, but I couldn't have told you another captain in the majors.
I mean, Jason Veritek and sort of that was it.
Veritek. They stuck the C in Jason Veritek's jersey, and he tried to take it off.
Back in the day, right?
Yeah, and he tried to take it off.
You know, but to answer your question, I think that's a valid question. I do think now there's an expectation that John Tavares would step out and speak his mind. Last year, he was a first-year player here. You know, he's probably looking maybe at Morgan Riley, who's been here for 5-6 years, even Jake Gardner, who's been here for a number of years and sort of said, well, I'm not going to suddenly step out and start dictating what I think the team's feeling. Now the expectation is he's going to play that role, not just with management, but you know what's going to happen? They're going to be leading 4-1 one game and go and blow a third period lead. And someone's got to go out and face the media, and it's going to have to be him. Mm-hmm. And that's a role that not every guy sits that well with every player. He's going to have to be marched out there after every single game and every off day, and that's the expectation. And Matt Sundin did it with a smile on his face. Doug Gilmore, Wendell Clark, Daryl Sittler. It's a significant role in the sense that you do have that responsibility, I think.
I'll tell you one thing that was just interesting to me, and I think David can back me up on this because, you know, both of us lived in the States. Like, there is something about being a captain on this team, on this franchise, in the way there is about being the captain of the Yankees that is not the same as being the captain of the Miami Dolphins or Arizona Diamondbacks. And that has been interesting for me to watch as an observer, how much attention, how much interest, how much passion, how much people cared about this decision, where in many other cities, like, this gets named and it's, you know, but it's you know, in the newspaper, it's, you know,
any hockey city would be a big deal, Richard.
You think so?
I think any hockey city,
Canadian hockey city.
You think it's a big deal?
Well, I'll give you an example.
Who the Arizona Coyotes name is captain?
No.
Carolina Hurricanes just shot out a tweet a few days ago. Hey, Jordan Staal's our new captain.
There you go.
It just sort of was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was not met with the same sort of fanfare. I agree with Richard. I think there's global brands. When you say Manchester United, it's different than when you're saying.
That's true.
You know, fair Tottenham enough. Or someone. When you say the Dallas Cowboys, the, you know, Green Bay Packers, or you're a Vikings guy, whatever. But when you say those brands, you know, the New York Yankees, the Toronto
Maple Leafs. Just a Team England. Like, I know John Terry was the captain of the English soccer. So I couldn't tell you who the captain of the
Cameroon.
The French team is. I probably should. That team, I knew who the captain was.
So there certainly is a cachet to it, and it has more relevance. And you posed that to Brian Berg, didn't you? And what did, I mean?
That's when he was like, the Islanders.
Yeah,
and so he said, Christ.
Is it, you know, and it's funny because I was just out last week in Calgary, Vancouver, and Edmonton doing some sit downs with some players, and we started talking about the captain's situation in Toronto, and a couple of the players said to me, like, is this the media just building up? And it made me think, and I was like, well, we probably do talk about it ad nauseum, but why do we talk about it ad nauseum? Because there is an appetite, we think at least, that people want to talk. You know, we've been on the air for 10 minutes now talking about it.
How much do you think some of this is, and this is an interesting part, like, how much of it is legacy? How much of it is because you can point back to 1922 and this guy had it in the way, like, you know, it almost seems mythical, but like Lou Gehrig was the captain of the New York Yankees. Like, it just seems like he was a real person, but like he seems larger than life. And that's where I think for some of these franchises, including this one, like that letter does signify something where I would argue for so many other franchises. Like, first of all, I don't even know this, but like, and Shia, you might know this. Like, do the Diamondbacks have a captain?
No,
the Astros?
It's a very
atypical.
Blue Jays
don't have a captain.
Blue Jays don't have a captain.
I mean, most teams typically don't. And to me, I think, Richard, to your point, in a market like this, it's about the symbol, which is why I asked about what's functionally changed. Like,
right.
I mean, the power, internal power structures in that room, I don't think are dynamically altered, but the symbolism within the market, the narrative around the team certainly changes. And that's why I think in this market, we spent far too much time on this, because if the Leafs are going to get anywhere, it can't just be John Tavares leading the way. You know, they need Austin Matthews playing a leadership role. They need Mitch Marner playing a leadership role. They need Morgan Riley playing a leadership role. And that's the only way you ever get somewhere.
We romanticize it to what the point I think you're both making. However, the one tangible thing with hockey, harken back to June, and the Toronto Raptors are your NBA champions. And who are the first three guys to get their hands on the trophy after the commissioner? It wasn't it wasn't Kawhi Leonard who basically,
it was ownership.
It's the owners. And that's fair. They're paying all the bills. And Larry Tannenbaum, my goodness, he has suffered through, you know, a quarter century of hard times. He deserved to have his hand on the trophy as much as anyone. But my point is, in hockey, it goes from the commissioner to the captain. And there's that iconic moment. We did it.
It's a great point.
We did it. And it is the one time where they stand out. And it's the one thing that's tangibly different about the NHL compared to any other sport. And I think that's where, you know, ask Alex Pietrangelo how he felt about being the captain. Is it relevant? Yeah. I was the one who held the cup up and said, you know.
But by the way, just also proves Amber's correct. Like, literally, the NBA needs to change that. Why the hell do the owners get their hands on that trophy?
Every sport except hockey.
They do it in baseball, too.
You're right.
The NFL, the NFL is usually the head coach in
the worst. The worst.
Well, it's just, you just don't like Robert Kraft.
No one cares less about the players in the NFL, right?
Yeah, true.
You know, I think one of the other things with Tavares, though, there is a significance to John Tavares in that one of the things Brendan Shanahan and Kyle Dubas have been big on, certainly Brendan Shanahan's been big on, he's talked about it since he came here, the idea that you want this franchise to become attractive to players from other markets. You want this franchise to become attractive to guys from this city because there's a ton of NHL players from this area. And David, you know, I mean, we all know for the longest time, you didn't want to play here because there was that warped history. There was a weight of expectations that were never going to be reached. And now I think the Leafs are trying to create this idea that there's a sort of a safe space here. And if you want to come to Toronto and play for the Leafs, you can have a good life. You're not going to be eaten up by the media. The pressure's not going to do you in. Look, John Tavares made the decision, and he's happy. He's so happy that he's our captain. And I think there may be some significance to it in that regard.
Yeah, there's seven or eight players on the team from Ontario and quite a few from the GTA.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. There was a time when we didn't really identify it as sort of Toronto's team in the sense of the players out there on the ice. And now it really does have that feeling to some degree.
Yeah, I think it really is part of the – I don't know how much it played in terms of Brendan Shanahan or Mike Babcock or Kyle Dubas' decision, but I'm sure it had to play a little part in it.
Yeah. You know,
even the way they announced it.
I think
the video, and you made a point of this, you know – and Brian Burke said, I wouldn't have done
like
the video.
I don't like that video.
From Oakville, that part?
But the video of like his kid.
The baby had the jersey.
But to me, there's messaging there. And the messaging is, you're safe here. You know, we're a family. Look, our captain's got his family here. And it's kind of hackneyed, but I think that was the message to a lot of players around the league. And you're going to keep seeing that. It's okay to come here and play. You may have to take a discount now because of all the money we're paying our guys, but it's okay to come here.
But that one thing, Jeff, I think you have hit on, though, is that, you know, and I'm one who I absolutely love the video that they had of Tavares being, you know, his wife in there, his baby in there. Certainly there's some stagecraft, but I thought it was cool. But there is a narrative that the Maple Leafs were pushing, and that is hometown guy, guy you can rely on all the time, gets the C. That was pretty smart messaging, in my opinion, by the organization. Also, I think they're putting a pretty good message out there.
Also, a guy getting a chance to fulfill his dream, right? All the way. Not only did he get to come back and play for the Maple Leafs, now he gets to be the captain, too. I think it's brilliant from that standpoint. But I keep coming back to, and I get those considerations. Like, if that's not the right thing for your room, you can't do it. You know what I mean? Like, and clearly, John Tavares is the right thing for that room.
What was Babcock's line? If the fans think they chose the captain, if the players think they chose the captain, if ownership thinks that they chose the captain, if the coach thinks he chose the captain, if everybody's happy with it, then it's got to be the right. It's got to be the right decision.
Mm. Yeah, and you know what? I think guys make a good point. Being a guy who chose to come here, you know, Morgan Riley was drafted, didn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. Austin Matthews was drafted and Mitch Marner was drafted. And I'm sure they all would have loved to have had the C slapped on. My point is John Tavares is the one guy you actually willingly, and he left money on the table to come here and be a member of the Maple Leafs.
So we've got our first back-to-back for the Leafs. Tonight they're in Columbus. Then, as I mentioned, they're home to Montreal. We know that Frederik Andersen is going to start tonight. He started the opener. David, this is one of the storylines that we spent a lot of time talking about in camp was just how valuable Freddie Andersen is to this team and how it's, one, important to see just how good Michael Hutchison is as a backup, but two, the idea that you were going to have to exercise some load management with Freddie Andersen. and these games come fast in the first month. I'm going to be interested in seeing how they go about using Freddie Anderson, how they pick their spots. You know, Jim Ralph was on the other day, and he was saying he'd like to see them. I think it was Jim Ralph was saying, I don't want them to just use Hutchison in the second part of back-to-backs. I'd like to see them give Freddie a couple of days off, use Hutchison in a couple of games. How do you think they're gonna handle this? Do you think you go with Freddie right now, try to win as many games as possible, and then cross that other bridge when you come to it?
Yeah, I mean, we've heard Mike Babcock say that. If I had the luxury of knowing my team can win with the backup, and also if I had the luxury of knowing we have enough buffer to afford him the rest that we'd like to give him. Yeah. But I agree full out. I mean, Jordan Binnington, they ran the table with him, but he only started in January.
Yeah.
Right? I think he made 37 starts or something. Tuukka Rask had some personal issues during the start of the season. They had this great backup in Jaroslav Halak. He only made, I think, 45 starts or 44 starts. Freddie Anderson has started more hockey games in the last 3 years than any goalie in the National
Hockey League. Averaged 64 games.
The most. He's had the most starts in the last 3 years. He's faced the most shots. He's been on the ice the most time. It takes its toll on you. One thing about the front-loaded schedule, guys, is maybe you're going to burn them out a little bit early, but then in March you can rest them leading up. Mm-hmm. Now, again, it's all going to be incumbent on them winning some of these games and having a bit of wiggle room, because I do think home ice is important, and I think you got to fight for that. The nightmare scenario is the Leafs finishing third, Boston finishing second, and it's going to a seventh game, and why even don't even get on the plane? It's over, right? Like, just psychologically, you have to think it's over. So there is an advantage there, a tangible advantage for them to try and fight as hard as they can for home ice advantage, and if they have the luxury of being comfortable with it, then you can maybe rest ready. And quite frankly, if Hutchison plays tomorrow and his lights out, suddenly you go, okay, great, this guy can handle it. He hasn't started more than 25 games, I don't think, in 3 years. So this is a big question mark.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably the biggest question mark on the team is, will they get the backup goaltending they need?
The one thing, you know, Kyle Dubas has said quite often that he's a big fan of the Raptors and how Masai Ujiri and that group did their stuff. So the Maple Leafs have had to see how the Raptors managed Kawhi Leonard. And they have a high-performance staff and a sports science staff. And I understand sort of this old sort of hockey, you know, whatever, mantra of, you know, you play you drop
and
leg
go
blah, blah, blah. If the Maple Leafs are as smart as I think they are, they will load management Freddie Anderson. He's on the cusp of 30. That guy should play right around, in my opinion, 50 or so regular season games, maybe a touch more. And if this backup is not the right backup, figure it out. I think we all agree Freddie Anderson is the most important member of Toronto Maple Leafs. He's not the best player, but he's far and away the most important member. And I think if you want to go as far in the postseason as you think you can go, that number that Jeff cited, 64, should scare the hell out of most people. Like, I think that has to be way under 60. And I would say try to do it as close to 50, understanding that if your backup is getting blown out, you know what? This is where you pay your general manager big money to figure it out.
And those are hard minutes that Freddie Anderson played. He's not sitting there while the puck's constantly in the other team's zone. I mean, the Leafs give up a lot of chances. They're a risk-reward type
team. One of the highest shot. Did he face the most shots last year?
He faced the most shots.
Okay, there you go.
He made the most saves, and he played the most ice time of any goalie over the last, I think it was 3 years. So, yeah, it's a lot, and it's taxing. And probably both emotionally, like psychologically, you know, having to bear down like that, and obviously physically as well. I agree with you, and I think I saw this recently. There's only been one goalie, I think it was Jonathan Quick a few years ago with LA, that started more than 60 games on their way to a championship. So, you know, if you are going to follow the numbers and look at the analytics of the whole thing, then the ideal spot would be somewhere like.
And look at the Blues. Look at the real numbers of Binnington. I know he came up late, but maybe there's some value or some learnings there that you can find that the guy was, generally speaking, super fresh in the postseason.
And go back the 2 years previous to that. Washington Capitals won the year before. Grubauer was in net. You know, Holtby had to jump in midstream in that. Go back the year before. Matt Murray, Marc-Andre Fleury split the net not once but twice on their way to championship. So recent history dictates, you can't have your guy playing 64, 63, 62 games and expect him in April, May, and June to get through the playoff rounds.
Yeah, and shy because, the big problem is if you do play 64 regular season games, if you are going to go on a run in the playoffs, we're talking, four series? I mean, theoretically, you're
could play 28 games.
Could be 28 more games.
Exactly. Right.
At the end of the year, you're looking at if you start
64 starts.
92 starts. Jeez.
I mean, this certainly, given their cap situation, isn't possible for the Leafs. But you just look at that evidence, and you look at the fact that data shows the less your starter plays during the regular season, the better a chance you have of success in the postseason. Is this not an opportunity for someone to spend a little bit more on a backup goalie? And is there
what
not
the Lightning did.
Go get Carey Price?
Well, I mean, sure. No, but like in the middle range, I mean, I understand teams are trying to minimize their salary cap hit with your backup goalie. But if you're going to be playing somebody for 30 to 35 games in order to optimize your goalie, I mean, part of what you're spending there is the ability for your starter to be at his best come postseason time.
Well, and maybe Michael Hutchinson's this guy. Maybe even though he's a low cap hit, maybe he is the guy. And Brian Burke said earlier today on Hockey Central with Jeff Merrick and Anthony Stewart, like, I liked what I saw of him a few years ago when, you know, they were scouting him and looking at him. Here's a guy, he has some pedigree. He's not completely fresh. It's not,
he's
you know,
a big guy, too.
Big guy. You know, Garrett Sparks didn't really have an NHL resume.
Yeah.
He had a spectacular, incredible AHL resume, won the Calder Cup, but he didn't have an NHL resume. This guy's an NHL resume. So I think we should at least, that's probably going to be the key storyline tomorrow. Can he go in there? And even if they don't win, if he plays well, the level of confidence will go up. If he gets torched, Garrett Sparks' first game last year was Sunday in Chicago. I think he gave up six. They won, the Leafs won. They won 7-6, but he gave up six goals. There was no confidence.
And I remember Berkey said with us, Jeff, he's like, you got to play the guy. You have to see, you have to, as early as you can, you have to get the learnings of what this guy is. Yeah. So I would play him like I don't know if I
could start him tomorrow night, though. I almost got Saturday night against the Habs, I've almost got to go with Freddie Anderson.
Division rival home game. I thought they would have flip-flopped,
exactly,
but Mike Babcock always has the backup, traditionally, waiting on the second night. He wants to have, but to me, I would go, I'm with you, I would have done.
You don't think,
aren't you getting a better read, though, on what Hutchinson is if he comes out tomorrow and has a great game? You know, if Freddie Anderson ends up getting hurt at some point and you have to run with him, don't you want to know what he's going to be like in a bigger stage?
The only thing is it's the second game of the year, and we're talking about, and I'm talking about this, but I think this kind of gets to what David said. I'd rather give Michael Hutchinson the start against a non-division team. I want to win as many games as I can within the division, because ultimately that is going to be important. And I think if I was picking and choosing, I would have looked at this as an opportunity to start Michael Hutchinson. Then I've got Freddie Anderson against a division rival. I am surprised. I'm surprised that this is the way it went.
Just real quick, and I would go the reverse, because my thought would be that I think Columbus in their home opener will be flying, and that would worry me a little bit playing my backup, where I understand the pressure of a division rival and playing at home, but I don't know. I don't love the matchup of playing against a team in their home opener, the crowd is going nuts, and the players' legs are fresh. That would scare me a little bit more.
Does it put more emphasis on tonight's game? What if the Leafs lose tonight?
Then it'll be panic.
Panic in the streets.
If they lose to Montreal, we'll have to put the flame retardant material up here again.
Yeah,
we haven't had to bring it out.
You don't
want
to work on Monday if they're 1-2.
It's down here. It's down here.
They'd be 1-2 on Monday facing the defending champs.
Oh, that's right. The Blues.
We're getting a little ahead of ourselves here.
Exactly.
But it's just the funny scenarios do play out sometimes.
We've talked a lot in this show about the idea of college athletes getting paid in the States. California has enacted the Fair Play to Pay Act, which would open the door for athletes to get paid for the use of their imaging rights by colleges and by leagues. It's an issue that has gotten a lot of support from a lot of big-name athletes. LeBron James, Draymond Green, very outspoken. Ed O'Banion, I believe, was the former UCLA and NBA player who really sort of started this. We've got a former college athlete, David Ember, here.
No.
Oh, I thought you said he was.
I thought you were.
No, I'm just the civilian.
Well, we're still going to talk about it. We're still going to talk about it anyhow.
Were you a star club athlete?
But the idea, because we've talked about college athletes getting paid or getting some sort of compensation. And what really brought this home for me was Draymond Green, of all people, and CNN saying, look, let me boil it down the simple things for you. Guy serving burgers at a college basketball game burns his hand. He can get workman's comp. Star quarterback blows his knee out. He's got nothing. He may lose a scholarship. So we're not at the point yet where athletes are going to get paid necessarily for what they do on the field. But the idea that you should get some money when your rights are being used to help market a product, something I think a lot of people can get behind. And we'll talk about that when the Friday Roundtable continues. It's Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Oddshark.net is your source for the latest odds from leading authorities, expert editorial content, and detailed matchup picks. Looking for statistics and trends from an upcoming game? Oddshark.net has that too, and it's free.
It's free.
Expert in-depth analysis, stats, numbers, and trends to help you make the sharp game day picks. Whether you want to get in on the football action, tonight's baseball game, or anything in between, head over to Oddshark.net and start playing like a shark today. This is not a gambling site.
Now back to Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to the Roundtable. David Amber, Shai Davidi, Richard Deitch, Jeff Blair. A reminder that the time is rapidly going by for you to register your rec hockey team for the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup, which will be held at the Mattamy Athletic Center. And for the past couple of weeks, we've been asking you to go to sportsnet.ca/590, enter your team's name for a chance to play at the Mattamy Athletic Center. You'll have your game called live on air by Joe Bowen on Jim Ralph. It'll be piped into the arena while you're playing, and there will be an after party. And apparently, I'm going to be a mascot at this thing. So anyhow, this is your last week to enter. Submit nominations and find details at sportsnet.ca/590. I've always wanted to be a mascot and see if I can get away with stuff.
What is the best mascot, you think, today in sports?
I think it's still the Fanatic.
I'm telling you, the Raptor is great, though. I mean, he doesn't do as much as he used to.
Yeah.
Middle-aged guy.
Yeah. The Raptor is a phenomenal athlete, but in terms of just being flat out flirty and dirty, nothing beats the Fanatic.
What about the San Diego Chicken?
I've seen the Fanatic do some things that are
illegal in some states.
In American college sports, I like the Michigan State Spartan. You ever see like the big Spartan on the sideline? It's a good like hearty mascot.
What about the Orange? I love the Orange.
Oh, the Orange team. That's like it's like the tree.
That college mascot is spectacular.
It's just so different.
I don't like animals. Like I don't like bringing the bull on the field or the bulldog.
Well, you guys have probably never gone to LSU. Well, like you know, they have a tiger, like a real tiger. That's kind of real.
So don't mess with that.
We don't do that stuff.
I mean, UP is a great mascot, but he's out of place with the Canadians, you know?
McGill, I kind of like mascot.
We were the Red Men, and now they've changed it to, I think, just the Red or something. I should know that. I don't know that. But I don't remember a mascot now.
Okay. See, I thought you were a college athlete, and you'd remember that.
I know.
Got the whole bio wrong.
Bad intel. Although I did find out that you have Syracuse in your background.
Well, there you go.
That's
you
a legit team. Athletic team.
I was there when Donovan McNabb and Marvin Harrison and Rob Conrad, they had a very good, Dwight Freeney, they had a very good team. It was fun.
That had to be a bowl team, right?
We got our butts kicked, though. We played against Jesse Palmer down in the Orange Bowl in Florida. I went down to the game. In fact, I was covering Doug Flutie with the Bills on the Sunday, so on the Saturday night, I went to the Orange Bowl, and I think they put up 55.
Who would have been the basketball star at the time?
John Wallace was the only guy who went to the NBA. They went to the final. I graduated in December, and they went to the final, and they lost to a Kentucky team with five NBA players. It was the Pitinos, Nazee Muhammad, and Ron Mercer, and that crew.
Well, this is a good segue, because you talked about how Donovan McNabb, they'd be driving around in
normal vehicles
and there would be other kids at campus from wealthy family who would be driving families who'd be driving abnormal vehicles and the reason the segue works is we want to talk about California's Fair Play to Pay Act, which was signed into law by Gavin Newsom, the governor of California. It doesn't mean college athletes are going to be paid a salary to play play football, basketball, whatever. But Richard, it does open the door for them to get some money for the use of their imaging rights. And by that, we're talking about if you're using, I don't know, the quarterback of UCLA and the quarterback of USC, if you're using their likeness to promote the upcoming game between those two teams, now there should be an avenue for them to gain some financial recompense for it.
Yeah, I've always been sort of a pro player, pro athlete in this. They're the ones who ultimately produce the revenue at these schools, and it's immensely frustrating, I think, to have somebody who's who is putting essentially or creating all that revenue and cannot fairly compensate for it. The NCAA is, in my opinion, always use this sort of time-honored BS. Well, we're compensating them with a free education and free room and board. But the reality is, and anybody who has either ever been to certainly an American college or covered it knows that these are not regular students. David, you went to Duke, you know this. Their time commitments are essentially like a real job. Mm-hmm. They often cannot take the same classes that regular students can. They are pushed into certain curriculums to essentially continue their eligibility. This act will only really affect the elite of the elite, including Olympic athletes. And in my opinion, just like a 17-year-old woman or man can earn money in tennis or some of these other sports, these athletes should be allowed to get paid. So I'm a big supporter of this bill. I congratulate California for doing it. I'm sure there's still a legal road to fight, but it just strikes me as fair more than anything else.
I think there's a great level of hypocrisy, too, to the whole situation. We were talking off air, and Shai, you were making a really good point about, you know, they have less rights than the average person. It's not that they have the same rights and they're granted a free education. They actually have fewer rights. They're not allowed to have a job outside of it. And as you said, they can't take a full curriculum. It's going to take them, the average college student, it's going to take them more than 4 years to graduate unless they do a whole full workload in the summer as well. They're held to, you know, several practices. 12 months round, essentially, and practicing on their own because you only can have X amount of college-type practices. And it's unconscionable that they don't get any money based on the amount of money, the scope that's being paid. I mean, I looked up a few things. You know, the SEC, ESPN's paying $300 million a year for the next 20 years. That's $6 billion. Where's that money going? And that's just one conference, right? Where is that money going? I mean, Nick Saban is the highest-paid state employee in Alabama. And he would argue, I guess, well, look at all the recruiting I'm doing and I'm bringing in a lot of money. That's fair. But what about the players? And they're one blown knee away from that's a pipe dream, what their future is going to hold. So it just seems like there's enough pie to go around. And certainly it seems like it's the right thing to do.
And David, you went through the other numbers beyond that $6 billion figure. And when you consider the scope of how much money these athletes are generating for these schools and for the NCAA, it is completely exploitive. They are generating back revenue for the schools well beyond the cost of their education.
Yes.
And the irony, as you were mentioning, is that everyone in academia pretty much is arguing constantly about the exploitation of workers, but it's fine for them to exploit their students in this fashion. And so, you know, the absurdness of it all, where they can have advisors but not agents who are guiding them through what could be a potentially multi-million dollar process with professional leagues, advertisers who are all trained in paying people as little as possible. So you can't even allow them to have proper representation. These kids can't even go back and give hitting lessons or skating lessons or whatever back home in their communities without risk of losing their eligibility. All these things are so archaic that, you know, in I don't know, 20, 30 years' time, I'm very hopeful, and, you know, I believe that we all should be looking back at this and saying, how did we let this go on this long?
Let me, the counter argument, though, obviously, guys, is that they are getting an education. That is the counter argument, though, right? They are getting a free education as a result of this. How do you argue against that?
Because it's not true. It's just, factually, it is not true. Some will get a free education, but as David said, they are essentially contracted workers with a job. Their job is to compete in that sport, and the athletics are secondary. And it's just been proven time and time again. If you talk to any of these athletes, either those who become professionals or those who just simply are very, very good college athletes, they will tell you that their time is not the same as an average student. They cannot be, they do not get the benefits of a free education without the requirements of the athletic part, which takes away, I think, from the free education. If you want to say they get free room and board, that's probably a fair argument, whatever that means. But for those of us who have been at college, I mean, it's not exactly Shangri-La. The thing that's so frustrating, though, and this is where, like, I really, like, would love to take, like, the ESPNs and the CBSs, like, of the world, like, just to school, is that what sells these games are the players. The old argument that, like, I'm tuning in to watch Alabama versus Michigan because I love the colors of the jerseys is bogus. You're watching that game because, like, Alabama has an incredible quarterback who probably will go first in the draft. Like, you watch Texas A&M a couple years ago because Johnny Manziel may do something, like, incredible. Like, that is what drives the whole business. And, David, you worked at ESPN. They don't put, like, a generic, like, Michigan sticker on. They put a football player on there who's the star of the team because it's that player versus that player. And everybody, like you said, with the stats that you have, everybody's getting paid. Athletic directors, assistant athletic directors, trainers, coaches. The only people who don't get paid are the players. And then lastly, which has always been something that bothers the hell out of me with the NCAA, is they don't even allow the players to transfer, like to choose a different school without being penalized to sit for a year, where the coaches of the sport can transfer to any other, essentially transfer, right, to any other school for more money. Everything is situated against the players.
And, you know, Shai, this is going to be, there's this sort of budding conflict in all sports, not just in college, but there's this budding conflict in sports. We've heard people with baseball talk about this. Sort of the nexus between the growing acceptance of legalized gambling as a means of revenue for sports teams and the proprietary information, biometric information, biomedical information about your players. And, you know, the idea that that information is going to be made available to people who set odds, they're going to be seeing that, you know, made available in real time in game. And one of the big arguments in sports now is who controls that information? Like, literally, who controls, if you're an athlete, who controls your biomedical information? And this is why I think there's going to be some fight back here, because this is just a thin edge of the wedge in terms of athletes being paid. I mean, if we go beyond here, and now we're getting into biomedical stuff and rights there.
Yeah, who owns it? I mean, David, thing with the Olympics, like, it's inconceivable to me that somebody, you know, whether it's like Kylie Mass in Canada or Katie Ledecky, you're one of the best swimmers in the world.
And you can't monetize it.
You cannot monetize that in a sport where you're only going to be great between 18 and 24.
Correct.
Like, that is infuriating to me. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, like, these football players are eventually going to get paid when they're 27. But Katie Ledecky or Kylie, like, literally their athletic prime probably ends at, like, 25.
Probably ends when they're as soon as they get out of college.
So how can you not allow them to capitalize on that? It's infuriating. Or what you're doing is you force them to make a choice. You can either be a college athlete or you can be a professional swimmer at 19 years old.
But to me, part of the difference, and Jeff, when you said that we played devil's advocate and you said, look, we're giving you the education. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's fine. That's okay. And if you're going like 20 years ago, there wasn't a massive surplus in favor of the universities with that transaction. You know,
that's fair.
Why do the universities get to take, or the schools and the NCAA and the athletic directors, why do they get to take that surplus that the players are earning for them? And that to me is where the problem is. And, you know, you get into the gambling and the biometric stuff. That's just another element of surplus that these college athletes are providing these schools and are seeing no return over and have no control. All of that.
Video games.
Video games is big, right? These TV deals are astronomical. The video games, it's a huge industry. And
that's
and it's
about
not
the players.
Trickling down at all. And I think we're all somewhat in agreement here. And I know you obviously want to get the debate flowing. It is somewhat of a one-sided argument. In my eyes, I just don't see, there's such a big scale of money here.
Right. Yeah.
And it just seems like it's flowing into very few pockets. Yes, they're building a lot of infrastructure. You know, I was at the Stanford campus last summer. I mean, it is beautiful. And a lot of that's built on, you know, the Bill Gates of the world giving money. And a lot of it's built on their athletics, which is second to none. So everyone does benefit from that. But the fact of the matter is a lot of these players, you know, again, they're on a campus with a lot of kids who are able to get jobs or come from affluent families, and they're kind of living a tougher life. And 99% of them aren't going on to make a living based on the sport they're in.
A little, I'm curious how you guys feel about this. Closer to home, how do you feel about something like the OHL? Should those kids, not college age, I understand, but younger, but creating some kind of revenue, essentially at least in terms of people who are watching them live, and some of those games I would assume in some places must be on television or radio.
Right here. Yeah.
What do you, how do you guys feel about, should they be compensated? I realize they're younger than a traditional college athlete.
I mean, similar to the university athletes is that they're creating revenue and they should be able to obtain any surplus. Now, I think the counter argument to that, and this isn't the case in the NCAA, is that, well, these owners can potentially and sometimes do incur losses.
Mm-hmm.
And so are you going to put that on these teenagers, and is that fair? And I think that makes it a bit more of a tricky debate. But I think in this instance where there's blatant evidence of an extreme surplus in terms of the revenue that they're creating versus what they're getting in return, you know, I think that's a different animal.
I think the thing with junior hockey too, and David, you could probably speak to this, is I don't know how you would pay the players, because I don't pretend to know the business of junior hockey, but I would imagine that there aren't too many junior teams that could pay their players meaningful money. And I mean, if you're going to give a guy, if you're going to give somebody $3,000 or $10,000 to play for you, I don't know. I'd rather you pay for.
I could be wrong, but aren't they guaranteed a university education?
And that's the point. I think there is a safety net built in for them. You know, hey, you play out your OHL career, you don't end up making it to the NHL, et cetera. You choose to not maybe go the route of the AHL, whatever options are open to you, and they are going to provide you with the ability to
go to college,
get to a Canadian university,
right,
and often get a good education. So I think it's actually a very different thing. And we're not talking about billion-dollar
TV. I just don't know how you...
Yeah.
I do think the scope is different. I think I get the ideology of it, but I think it's a very different argument.
No, I appreciate
that. And I think if you talk to some of the guys who run the teams in the OHL, they would say, okay, well, we can start paying. And then, you know what? A year later, we're not going to have a team here.
See, I mean, I think we're seeing, correct me if I'm wrong, there's a plan afoot, and maybe it is that O'Banion and his people, that starting a league that would allow kids to play and be paid before they're drafted.
Yeah.
Avoid college, play and be paid before they're drafted. You go over to Europe
that might
and do
be,
that as
that
well.
That might be Brady's agent's league.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah. So the notion would be that the NFL will not allow you to be drafted, I think, until you have, I think it's completed either 2 or 3 years of college, or you have to be a certain chronological age. And this basically would be a bridge where if you don't want to go through the charade of being a university student, you play in this sort of professionalized mm-hmm. league for a year or two, and then you can go to the NFL. What is an interesting proposition, I don't know if they'll be successful or not, is there probably will be kids who really have no interest in being students,
right,
who are, you know, potential like first round picks. And do they, rather than go through work, play for Alabama, where you're creating all this revenue for Alabama, go into this league and get paid $200,000 a year or something like that? Where we've seen this is the NBA. There have been kids who have gone to China.
Right.
Or, you know, I think the G League essentially is going to sort of be a place where
one of the ball kids is down in Australia.
Right. If you basically are like, I have no interest in the college system, I would like to be paid at 18, but I cannot obviously enter the NBA draft. To me, that makes sense. In the same way, like, you know, there are some people after high school who want to go into a trade. Like, they don't, college is not for their option. To me, that would make a lot of sense. Where, Jeff, it's like a little tricky is that, is there an audience for that league? Like, would people pay money to watch that? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
Well, the NBA just switched their policy. I mean, LeBron went straight from high school, and then,
correct,
and there were so many guys, Kevin Garnett and Kobe, et cetera, matriculating straight to the NBA from high school, that they said, well, let's hold on. We're going to make it a year. You have to be at least a year out of high school, right?
Yeah, now it's two. I think it's going to go back to one.
Yeah. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll take a look at the Toronto Blue Jays season. We'll wrap it up. Major League playoffs are on right now. Houston, Washington, and St. Louis all leading 1-0. The Cardinals are losing in their game against the Braves right now. Primetime Sports, Friday Roundtable on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right, a reminder, we want you to rack up your wings. Because that's because the wing and rib combo is back at St. Louis Bar and Grill from October 1st to 31st. Enjoy a half pound of wings and a half rack of grilled back ribs for only $17.99, served with St. Louis Bar and Grill's signature golden fries and famous garlic dill sauce. Plus, this is an important plus, I may add, enjoy a 23-ounce Devil's Pint of Alexander Keith's Michelob Ultra, Budweiser, or Bud Light for $5.99. In support of Autism Awareness Month this October, 50 cents will be donated for every 23-ounce Devil's Pint of Keith's Michelob Ultra, Budweiser, and Bud Light sold. All proceeds will go to support local schools for children with autism in their respective communities. Additionally, if you donate $5 at St. Louis Bar and Grill, you will get a coupon card with over $30 worth of savings. St. Louis Bar and Grill, devilishly good and shy. I think we've eaten well over $30 worth of wings that they so graciously provided.
We have we've certainly not been shy about helping ourselves.
No, we have not been shy about helping ourselves, and we thank our friends at St. Louis Bar and Grill. The Major League Baseball playoffs have commenced. The Los Angeles Dodgers won their first game against the Washington Nationals. The Atlanta Braves are currently leading, but they lost their first game to the St. Louis Cardinals, a bizarre game. And earlier today, to quote Kevin Cash of the Tampa Bay Rays, we were Verlandered.
We got Verlandered.
Justin
and they certainly did.
They certainly did. Justin Verlander had a no-hitter through four and a third. And the Houston Astros went on to win.
One hit over seven, eight Ks. Not a bad day.
No, not at all. And things going basically according to plan for the Houston Astros. You'll note that the Toronto Blue Jays are not in the postseason this year.
One kind of flew under the radar a little bit.
Just a little bit. Just flew under the radar a wee bit. We heard from Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro on Tuesday, their year-end media availability. And as is usually the case with these things, there's a small, little, tiny bit of insight into some stuff. I don't think any grand answers were necessarily given. This time of year, Shy, I don't think you can. I mean, you aren't even in a position where you can start talking. We can start talking to free agents. But that's even a time to look back on this year. Was this a step forward for this franchise? Or a step backwards? Or a step sideways?
It's an interesting question, and it's funny. Arden, Ben, and I talked about this on At the Letters earlier this week.
You got testy at The Letters.
Well, I mean, there was a little over-under competition between the two of them that I had a referee.
Jeez.
And now they're both mad at me. So,
well, you've done your job.
I really think that question depends through what lens you're looking at. If you're looking at it as, we want to give our customers a good product in 2019, well, I mean, you failed miserably. I mean, you subjected them to Socrates Brito and Alan Hansen and Zach Roscup and Edwin Jackson and Nick Kingham and a whole lot of other players that I will be scarred into my memory, but hopefully fans will be able to soon forget.
Sort of like Gio Urshela last year.
Right. I mean, just as a side note, wouldn't it be a great irony if Breivik Valera, the infielder the Jays plucked off waivers from the Yankees, turned into 2020 Gio Urshela?
It would be.
But, you know, so 20, like, in terms of what you gave the fans this season, you did not give them a good product. That's clear. Now, if the progress that they made this year and the experience gained by Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette and Kevin Biggio and Teoscar Hernandez and Jansen Maguire and all the other kids, Trent Thornton, some of the other young arms, Kay Zoik, if they're able to use some of that experience and springboard into 2020 and form the guts of a competitive club, you know, they're not going to be contenders next year, but if they're hovering towards 500, then this year will have been a success. But until we really see what the kids do with the experience they got out of this year and really what the front office does with the experience, with the knowledge that they gained from the players who appeared this year, it's too early to say that, because this season is about setting the stage for 2021 and beyond. And until we know what that looks like, I don't know that we can call this a success or a failure.
David Amber, I wanted to ask you this. We're watching right now. We've got the Cardinals game on. Watching Jack Flaherty pitch. Watch Justin Verlander today. Watch Tyler Glasnow throw 100 miles an hour a couple of times. I mean, we saw Walker Buehler. All we've seen is really good velocity from teams that are in the postseason. It's something the Jays just don't have. Maybe Nate Pearson will be the guy that can do that. And I know you're not supposed to, I mean, the thing to say is don't get carried away with the radar gun, but it seems like everybody in baseball is throwing hard. Does it concern you that you look at what's going on now and you look at the Jays and they literally, Shai, maybe you can jump in here. Other than Ken Giles, do they have anybody who is a legitimate hard thrower? Well, that concerns me.
What concerns me is the lack of stability. And what I mean by that is you had 21 different guys make a start this year. 21 different players made a start pitching for the Jays this year. 3 years ago when they were a playoff team, they had five guys start at least 29 games. Mm-hmm. Part of that was health. I know Shoemaker was supposed to be there, et cetera. But part of it is just they don't have the arms. And that speaks to what you're talking about. You look at the Houston Astros, and if that's the blueprint to how you have a successful franchise, and you look at Cole, Verlander, Greinke, I mean, that's a pretty formidable top three you're throwing out there. And Gerrit Cole, I mean, my goodness, that guy can throw right now. I mean, he's going to win the Cy Young, I would think, right?
Be him or Verlander.
For him or Verlander.
Yeah, it's going to play split the vote.
Coin toss, share. Yeah.
But I mean, this is now a power league. It's power at the bats, and it's power pitchers, and you're right, there's a lack of stability and a lack of arms there, and that's what to me concerns me. I think the growth of those three young players is phenomenal. The potential there is great. I mean, that could be the middle of the Jays lineup and the start of the middle of the Jays lineup for the next X amount of years, but without the arms, it's all going to be for naught.
Like, who do they have that throws hard legitimately
in terms of starters or like bullpen arms? I mean, Jason Adams got some velo, Justin Schaefer's got some velo. We're starting to thin out.
Yeah.
You got a lot of sort of average, slightly above average league velo guys. Trent Thornton has his moments when he's throwing hard. Ryan Barucki was throwing harder when he got hurt. But coming in the system, Alek Manoah, the first round draft pick, he's got a chance to be a big arm guy. Patrick Murphy he would have been here had he not, it's a convoluted story, but his delivery at double was ruled illegal by some double A umpires. He had to change his mechanics midway through the season, ended up suffering a shoulder injury the result of that. And so he would have been a factor of this. And he's a, high 90s, triple digit velocity guy. So they've got a handful of them, but there's certainly no depth. And, we heard a lot from Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro that they're going to address pitching. But I was thinking about this after the fact. The way that Ross Atkins positioned it, and he said it a couple times, so you could tell it was a scripted talking point, was that this free agent year was going to look more like the ones after the 15 and 16 seasons. And for him to get that specific about it is that he's trying to anchor that as a reference point. So he doesn't want the fan base letting their imaginations run wild. Hey, we're going to make a run at Gerrit Cole, or we're going to go for Ryu, or if Strasburg opts out or whatever. So the fact that that's where they're setting the bar, where, the biggest money they handed out was $36 million over 3 years to J-Hap. I mean, that's the range they're going to be shopping in. And maybe you can get a good supporting player, but the impact, it's not coming this offseason. It has to come from either within the system or from via trade down the road.
Yeah, the one thing, Jeff, in terms of velocity, it's interesting to hear Shai discuss the Blue Jays' prospects in the minors. I almost think you have to, Shai, with the number. You have such a high pick in the draft this year. I think you have to try to draft a power arm, even if, I mean, maybe if you are just so high on like a outfield prospect at that number five spot, but it strikes me that that almost has to be a power arm. And then the other thing they said that was interesting to me is, you know, and when Jeff asked, like, sort of how do you view this season, I view it sideways. And the reason I do is because I think you nailed it. You really can't evaluate this year until the end of next year. Because you really, like, logically, like, to get these young guys playing time and exposure to the major leagues is a big positive, and it'll pay dividends down the road. But until you sort of, I feel like, get a full year out of them next year, you don't really have any kind of sense of what this year meant. So to me, it's certainly sideways because, like, I don't think the pitching's in any kind of better position at the end of this year than it was at the beginning of the year, maybe with the exception of Trent Thornton, maybe. But, you know, by the end of the 2020 season, we could look back this year and be like, all right, this was a really huge developmental year for Danny Jansen, Reese McGuire, Bo Bichette, Vladdy Jr., but can't know that, I think, until the end of next year.
Yeah, I think everybody in the fan base and around the team, for that matter, would have felt better if more pitching would have emerged this
definitely
year. And
even if Ryan Brucki had just been healthy, that would be something to hang your hat
right
on.
Right, and I think you probably felt better about where the pitching was at the end of last season.
Absolutely.
When Ryan Brucki had come up and looked like he could be at least a back-end guy, if not maybe a mid-rotation guy, and that's not there now. And, you know, at that time, you still thought, okay, well, maybe they could work something out with Marcus Stroman, or maybe Aaron Sanchez bounces back, and you've got 2 years left of each of those guys, so you're either trading them for an asset, or, you know, maybe you're extending them and you've got a piece for the future. But, you know, Aaron Sanchez's value collapsed, and he wasn't going to be a factor. The relationship with Stroman played out as we all sort of expected it to, and they got a couple prospects, good prospects, maybe not the A prospects that people were hoping, but Anthony Kay looks like he's got the potential to be a piece perhaps next year, maybe a bit longer than that. But this is not more resolved. And it was the one area where even at the end of last year, even 2 years ago, where you looked at it and said, okay, well, I can see how this could play out from the position player side, but you didn't see a pathway to a rotation into the future. And you're still saying that right now.
It's a bit shocking, though, hey? When you think back to 16, it was so much fun in 16, and you had that. It wasn't the best rotation ever, but it was such a serviceable rotation. You know, Estrada, Happ, Stroman, Sanchez. Who else was in there? Dickey?
Ooh, no. Brain fart. No, not Dickey.
Dickey. Yeah, 16, Dickey,
yeah.
Dickey. And, I mean, so it's not going to knock your socks off, but they all were healthy. They were all serviceable. They were all getting things done. And now you look, and there's not even, like, those five are gone. And what do you have left to show for it?
Right.
Like, what?
Brandon Drury and Billy McKinney.
Yeah. It's kind of shocking.
No, I that's, you know, I was thinking this watching the Rays today. And I know Arden wrote this towards the end of the regular season, but we always talk about, oh, you got to chase the Yankees, got to chase the Red Sox, got to chase the Yankees, got to chase the Red Sox. You got to beat the Rays first. Mm. And the Rays aren't going... not going away anywhere. Their best position player probably finished the year in AAA, right? Wander Franco, one of their best position players.
Right. I mean, they're not just positioned well now with a 96 win team that won the wild card after a 90 win season, but they've got the number one farm system in baseball, so they're going to be able to continue to sustain themselves. Now, you know, well, when do their financial limitations start hampering them and, you know, they have to start making some financial decisions that force them to take a step back? I think that's why you don't worry about them in quite the same way as you do the Yankees and the Red Sox. But they're an obstacle, a major one. And the one thing they do, maybe better than anybody else in baseball, is they just keep pumping out these guys who throw high 90s and can throw for strikes. And they've got the staff to manage them creatively and figure out how to get 27 outs a night. And they do it with better than anybody.
It's interesting. The the Rays are an organization that always sort of makes me wonder if Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro are the right guys here. And I know that not everybody sort of can have that kind of outside the box thinking, and not everybody can have that kind of scouting prowess. But, you know, the reality is the Blue Jays are never going to be the Yankees or the Red Sox, where if you decide to just sort of spend to win, like, you have a shot. I'm not saying that's the best way to build, but you can – I think you can buy a postseason berth. I don't know if you can buy a World Series, but you can buy a if you are willing to spend, sort of making this up, $250 million, like, you can buy a postseason berth.
But, you know, San Diego and Washington might say, or sorry, Philadelphia and San Diego went out and got Machado and
Philly was close, Harper, but I agree with you. But, you know, Philly, let's say, bought another pitcher, maybe they do it. My sort of point is that this franchise is going to need to have very smart people at the top, in my opinion, to be able to compete with some other franchises that have so much sort of asset capital. In the Red Sox and Yankees, it's financial, including, by the way, also intellectual. I think Brian Cashman's a great GM. And then in the Rays,
it's intellectual.
They have proven creative. Too many times they're creative. So it is, you know, if you're a Jays fan, I do think there are some positives to look at, but now, I watch this postseason, and I see the Astros, and I look at their, like, roster, and I think to myself, the Jays are, like, a billion miles away from it.
Right, yeah. And look, I mean, the Houston Astros also lost.
They did.
You know, 300-something games in the span of 3 years to get that roster.
True.
So, you know, there hasn't been the same level of pain, but the Blue Jays have more money to work with than the Rays do, far more money. They don't have to be the Yankees and the Red Sox, and they don't have to be the Rays. They can be in the middle. What we haven't seen from this regime is how do they spend when they have financial flexibility. And they probably have in the neighborhood of $40 million to work with this offseason. You can do a lot of damage with $40 million, and they've got basically no money on the books in the coming years. You got Grichuk and Gurriel. Right. Yeah. Tulo comes off after next year. So you've got a clean slate. Based on their track record in Cleveland, we haven't seen them, save for a couple times where, you know, Nick Swisher and Michael Bourne got stuck in free agency. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen them go out in the market and make some sort of aggressive moves. They've been a very, very conservative front office. They've got some runway now. What are they going to do with it? And we don't know.
Just one question for you, Shai. Do you think if you were in charge, would you try to be aggressive this offseason, or would you wait? Even getting Tulo off the books, really having some crazy amount of capital and cash to spend, and go for it at the end of 2020, whatever the free agent market is in 2020, at the end of 2020.
I mean, this is interesting because I had a conversation with the Blue Jays executive this week, and there are various definitions of what being aggressive is, right? Like, so if you mean being aggressive, going to get Gerrit Cole, I don't think this is the winter for them to do it. But I think being aggressive and trying to get sort of that middle tier starter, somebody who's going to, at least a couple of them actually, some guys who can just give you consistent innings so you don't have to cycle guys in and out, sort of what Burley and Dickey were for this team, 14-16. That, I think, is where they need to be aggressive.
Yeah.
They need to add the supporting pieces so that the kids don't have to carry it all on their own.
See, I don't think there's necessarily a case of being aggressive this year or being aggressive next year, because first of all, to be in the safe side, you've got to assume you're never going to sign a free agent here, because it doesn't happen. Free agents don't sign here. So we can sit here and say we're going to be aggressive this year. Gerrit Cole's not signing here. He's just not. So my thinking is this team, conservatively, needs a couple of starting pitchers. It needs somebody who can play defense in center field. I think it needs another bat. It's going to need that to contend. So if you can address one of those things this offseason through free agency or a trade, you do it. If you can address none, if you don't, those options aren't there, then you focus on adding some stability to your rotation. But I don't think it has to be, we're going to be aggressive this year, or we're not going to do anything, because guess what? Your needs this year are going to be your needs next year.
Hmm.
The
other thing to consider is that this isn't a great free agent class.
No.
And money that you're spending now is money that you're not spending later, when the class could be better and your team could be closer, and you could have a more specific idea of what your needs are.
But to address what you and Jeff are saying, I understand, like, on the high end, it's not a great free agent class. Is it a good class for not a good class even for the mid tier?
No, I mean, like, okay. If you're talking about like
Jake Odorizzi types,
like middle tier, I mean, and Jake Odorizzi is a good pitcher and obviously helps his team, But when you look at his numbers, you have to remember that he did that in the junior varsity American League Central.
Yeah.
Right? So
he gives up a ton of home runs.
And he, you know, he did a lot of that against the Detroit Tigers and the Kansas City Royals. Mm. So,
and he doesn't strike out a lot of guys either.
No.
Right.
Okay.
Not a
good
power
point.
Pitcher
I got you.
Per se. But don't you need, I mean, you guys are bringing up a lot. I mean, they need a lot. There's a laundry list there that you just rattled off, Jeff. And I would even say it might need more than that to be a true contender.
I admit, I'm surprised. I'm surprised that we're sitting here in this state and they need as much as they need. Because I thought they'd have more questions answered.
It seemed more promising coming into this season as a pure fan perspective than it does coming out of the season. I mean, 97 losses will do that to you, and being really essentially out of it by end of April sort of plays on it. But to me, don't they need some veteran leadership's the wrong word, but they need some guys to show Guerrero, Bichette, Biggio, you know, keep the culture up, how to win, how to play. And like the OPS, it's not good. Like they don't manufacture runs.
No, they need guys who get on base.
Yeah,
100%.
They don't manufacture runs. Doesn't that, I mean, to me, and maybe it's because I'm in an age where I used to remember watching, you know, the St. Louis Cardinals and the way they would manufacture runs and get things to work for them. And it just doesn't seem to be set up with the personnel they have in place.
No, that's a great point. And, you know, in the summer, I wrote a piece arguing that the Jays should go get Edwin Encarnacion to be a DH in the middle of their lineup. You know, I'm revising my thinking now. I think actually the guy that they should go get is Mike Moustakas. I think he'd be perfect because he gives you some, he can play third, he can play in a pinch second, he can play some first. Great teammate, a little bit younger, left-handed bat, gives you some balance in the lineup. I mean, he's going to be expensive. He's going back into free agency for the first time without a qualifying offer. Be interesting to see how that impacts things. But that would really change things in the lineup, David. And I think it's a point that it hasn't been talked about enough, but it's something that I think the coaching staff believes in, thinks that they could really use. And it's just one of the many needs. Look, you know, I think in a lot of ways on the pitching side, we'd be having a different conversation if Ryan Barucki was healthy this year. And if Ryan Barucki comes back and next year and is just like Ryan Barucki at the end of 2018, I think the picture changes dramatically just on that one guy. And then you know that Nate Pearson's coming and eventually Alec Manoah and Patrick Murphy or Hector Perez or Yency Diaz, or, you know, there are enough bodies that you think someone will emerge. But they just need some pieces, and it's not just the pitching staff. They do need to address the lineup as well.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, the round table will take a quick whip around. We'll talk about the Major League Baseball playoffs. We'll talk about the NHL, the first full weekend of action, and the NFL as well. It's the Friday round table. It's primetime sports on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now back to primetime sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, it is a stretch drive, the penultimate stretch drive, Deitch. For the
round
table.
Yeah, I know, this is my last.
So this is your last round table.
Yeah,
when you come back, it'll be a square table.
Yeah, no,
we may not have any table.
Yeah, I don't want to make it about me, but I
you can make it about you.
No, I'm saying it's like I'm gonna miss it. The Friday round table for me was like always something, just like it was interesting. It was just always different from the rest of the week.
Because it's Friday.
I felt like, you know, McCowan was kind of interesting on a Friday versus other days.
I say that with a big smile.
Absolutely. And Jeff, you know this, like, it's just when you, and again, these are lottery ticket jobs. Nobody should be complaining with any of the jobs we have. But like after doing a whole week of sort of 3-hour interview, it's just nice to have like other people in the room to just like have to bounce things off of. So this was always like, I loved Fridays. It was like the most enjoyable day for me. And I'm glad we're doing it from 2 to 5, but I'm definitely going to miss it. It's been an institution, and I know an institution long before I got here.
Yeah. So just to remind people, we'll be going 2 to 5 a week from Monday. Brunt will be in next week, and we'll be doing roundtables for an hour on Monday and Friday.
Do you know who the other two guests will be on the last roundtable? Is that not decided yet?
I don't know because I won't be here myself.
So it's going to be so you need three.
I need three.
Three subs.
Will Brent host?
You should host.
That'd be cool.
I've got a family thing. So we need
Amber and Brent back again.
I'm sure we'll find somebody. I'm sure we'll find somebody.
Jeff, I do want to credit you on your use of one of my favorite words, penultimate, twice so
nice.
Far today.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully I know what it means. Why is penultimate one of your favorite words?
I don't know. It's just one of those words that you use it, and a lot of people are like, it forces people to look it up in the dictionary.
Yeah. You know what word I like? I'm probably going to mangle it. Oligenious. Am I pronouncing that right? Oligenious. It basically means like oozing and slimy. It's a great word to use when you want to put the hammer on somebody.
Right. Not as good as dinosaurian.
Dinosaurian.
Will forever.
I'll stick to loquacious.
Loquacious is always nice. That was like an SAT spelling word that I never got correct.
See, penultimate to me was always one of those words that should have meant something other than it does. Like it seems like it's, you know what I mean? It's such a good word. It seems like its meaning is wasted.
It gets so rarely used.
Right.
Does that make sense?
No, I know what
it's
you're saying.
It's a good word. Yeah. It should mean something really dramatic.
It's interesting. If you, unless they look at you with two heads, if you ask people for their favorite word, it is rather revealing, like, you know, what they say. Especially if, like, somebody answers, like, power or money.
Yeah, I would not. I've got a favorite word, and we couldn't say it on the air. I say it frequently enough. Mr. Deitch, seeing as how it is your last, I was going to say ladies,
penultimate question.
Ladies' choice for the dance, but no, you know what I mean. We'll give you,
on TV, they can't see the finger.
This is your swan song, so to speak, in this format, you can lead the discussion.
All right, so, you know, I think, you know, I'll be curious. You know, Jeff, I didn't tell you I was going to talk about this, but this is something I want to talk about with Shai and Amber.
I'll just leave the room.
Because I have no idea how they feel. But how do you guys feel about Bianca Andreescu and her sort of rise this year? To me, she's already clinched, you know, what we said, the Marsh Award or the Canadian Athlete.
Tell the folks why we're talking about it. But she lost today.
She lost today to Naomi Osaka. But I think she had won 15 or 16 in a row. Yeah. Obviously won the U.S. Open.
17, I believe.
17. No? Yeah. So the thing that's interesting to me, and I'm a big tennis head, so I'm sort of biased here, but do you think her success this year, is it enough or has it been enough to catapult more interest in tennis in this country? Like, was what she has done so far enough, or is it just a singularly fantastic year from somebody in a sort of a niche sport and we celebrate it as such?
I'll jump in here, and I'm probably a little bit biased. I was down at the U.S. Open. I had a chance to see her play the Labor Day weekend when she beat Wozniacki in two sets,
two.
But it was a good match. She has caught the attention of the country. The Saturday when she won the U.S. Open, I was going to the film festival, and we went to.
My God, you're a man of the world.
it was a fluky night, anyways. But we went to a premiere showing, right. and we went to this bar before that, and they had the sets on. It wasn't a sports bar; it was like a nice loungy place. They had the sound on, the screens on. Everyone was watching it, and I think she has everyone's attention. And I think it's not just a sort of passing fancy. Oh, that was cool. Let's move on. I also think because of her age, because she has a personable, there's something about her.
That she has a really good way. She has a very good public persona.
Yes, she does.
And she epitomizes the things. When you have kids, you're like, that's what you got. You know, it's not just about winning. It's how she wins gracefully. And, you know, she was down in some set. She comes back. It was just a beautiful story. And I think she's here to stay. And I think she's caught the attention of the Canadian public.
What are you shy?
You know,
I mean, I'd hope that that's the case, but my feeling is that we have a tendency to take a moment that really captures the public imagination and really kind of galvanizing across the country the way she was at the U.S. Open and extrapolate too much from it. And we are not traditionally a tennis country. We haven't had a tennis star like her, but we've had lots of good tennis players over the years who haven't captured people in the same way. And I know that it's different. She's got a strong social media presence. She's comfortable in the public eye in the way, say, a Daniel Nestor never was. But she's not a star in the biggest sport in this country. And I think that for big events or if she's getting into finals, people will line up and rally behind her. But are people going to be tracking her week in, week out when she's on the WA tour? I don't know as a tennis fan base across this country if we're there yet.
You know, I kind of draw a parallel between her and Penny Oleksiak. Can anybody tell me how many races Penny Oleksiak's competed in since the Olympics? I mean, she's competed in the World Championship. She's won a couple of events. But what I'm saying is most people who could have told you what her time was in the Olympics wouldn't be able to tell you what she's done since.
Not a fair comparison.
No, but here's my point. No, but my point is this. I'm saying I don't think that's a fair comparison, but when Penny Oleksiak, if you look at Rio, if you talk to people in the swimming community, the number of kids that started swimming after Rio went up.
Mm.
You talk to people in the Canadian soccer community. After that medal performance in London, the number of girls playing soccer went up. I don't think we'll know until we see how many kids take up the sport because of this. And this is where, Richard, I think you talked about this. This is why I think she will have a lasting impact because of her social media presence. She is not going away. And I think she's the type of person, if you're somebody who's 10, 11 years old or whatever, and you're sort of trying to figure out what sport you want to do, you want to do a sport, you don't really play hockey or anything, here's this person on social media who on a day-to-day basis is, I think it's going to have legs. I think it's really going to have legs.
I hope so, but I think the comparison you made with Penny Oleksiak is interesting because it did almost feel like one of those Olympic moments where, you know, everybody gets into it and it's something that nobody paid much attention to beforehand and paid attention to afterhand. You know, you covered 2010 in Vancouver. I was there in 2010, David.
I wasn't there in 2010, but I was there in Rio.
But I remember after 2010, everyone thought, man, this is going to change sport in Canada forever.
Everybody's going to be bobsledding.
Right. All these sports thought this is going to be this massive springboard moment. And to a degree, it was. But it wasn't this thing that became a national obsession, right? Like, not freestyle skiing is still freestyle skiing. Figure skating is still figure skating. They aren't national sports. And, you know, what Bianca did, and she will have a presence, but I don't think she's going to capture people in quite the same way because she did something that nobody had ever done before at a moment in time where the sports scene was kind of barren. And everybody could jump onto it.
But you know what? She's got a chance for a follow-up act. And I'm sorry to jump in here. But one thing being on a tennis tour, she's going to have multiple chances for a follow-up act within the next 12-month cycle, where Olympic athletes don't get that.
This is the thing. I think it's apples and oranges. I also think
I talked myself out of it. Thank you for that.
Tennis isn't bobsled. I mean, tennis is a much more mainstream sport. Yeah. And not just that. I took Richard's question a little bit different. I thought you meant, is she going to stick around? I didn't think, did she cause a wave of thousands?
Yeah.
I definitely think the level of interest was incredibly heightened. I mean, she's kind of like Cher, like you say, or Madonna. You say Bianca, people know who you're talking about. Yeah. I can tell you, and that's a strange thing. And I don't think it was just hey, she won the U.S. Open, let's go back to business now. I mean, I was following her when she won at Indian Wells, and I thought, wow, that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And I'm not the biggest tennis fan, but I'm certainly someone who follows the sport. And when she won that tournament, which is essentially, they call that the fifth major, I said, wow, she's already accomplished more than 99% of Canadian tennis players have ever done. So I think there's going to be some traction. I think there's some young girls that we're watching and young boys. Time will tell, as Jeff's saying, but I do think this is a storyline that we're going to have to follow.
Yeah, the last thing I want to say on this, I know we'll sort of move on, is to everyone's point, and Shai, yours as well, I think what will be a very big either difference maker or non-difference maker is where the tennis television rights ultimately go. Because one of the issues with Bianca's matches this year, right, is some of it on like DAZN, some are on TSN, some are on Sportsnet. And if there's access to more of her matches during a singular year, I think there's a possibility to sustain this.
That's fair.
Where I do think for sure, and this will be very, very interesting at least to watch, where I think she's really going to potential, maybe dominate's too strong, but where the news cycle will really, she'll be a big part of it, is the four majors and the Rogers Cup. And so I think if nothing else, let's presume she's a top five
and
player.
And the Olympics.
And the Olympics. So at least 8 or 9 weeks of the year out of 52, and assuming she's as good as we think she is, she should be pretty front and center in terms for our sports attention.
Richard, if the U.S. Open was on DAZN, how do you think that would have impacted the reaction to her?
I think it would have cut the interest in Bianca by like 70%. I think in order to celebrate these kind of moments, you have to see it. You have to be able to embrace it, feel it, be connected to it. So if it was on a streaming service that still very few Canadians get, it would feel like to me, Jeff, like the FIBA qualifiers for Canada basketball. Yeah. Like you'd read about it or you might follow it on Twitter or something like that, but you have no connection to it because you're not watching it live.
The Atlanta Braves just took a 3-0 lead. Adam Duvall just homering for the Braves. The fans are doing the tomahawk chop, which is just anyhow.
The only time I liked the chop was when Alomar did it.
Yeah, so I just Sean and I talked about this a little bit. The Cleveland Indians are sort of running and hiding from their logo, and the Atlanta Braves are merchandising stuff to be used in the tomahawk chop. It's insane. It's like nobody mentions the Braves.
No, and they get away with it. And this is not to say that Cleveland shouldn't be getting criticized for Chief Wahoo, because absolutely that's 100% justified. But I mean, I was in Atlanta the last 2 years, and I didn't make the trip this season. And when I saw it, I saw the fans doing it.
It's off-putting,
I was just like, how is this still happening? Like, it blew my mind that this was still tolerated.
And yeah, that was the segue. I was just thinking of that as we shifted topic, the home run happened. We mentioned the MLB playoffs are on. Whose legacy is most at stake in these playoffs? Got to be the Dodgers, isn't it? Is this a defining moment for that franchise? Or is there another franchise maybe facing a defining moment?
I mean, for them, this whole season has been about getting to the World Series. I mean, really, I mean, their season almost doesn't begin until game one of the World Series, because anything beyond that is pointless for them.
And anything up to that point is only going to be bad. Anything that happens up to that point is going to be bad.
Could this go down as one of the greatest Yankee championships ever, just based on the number of injuries they face? Like,
if they win it, it's going to be something else.
Pretty, you know, they had their whole lineup out at one point, you know, four of their top six guys or whatever. It's kind of unbelievable that they were able to, I don't know if they won 100 games, but I think they won.
Yeah, they won 100, and, you know, 106, I think.
And that might speak to some of the weakness at the bottom of their division, but still impressive.
The only thing is they're going to be, I think the Yankees are going to be around for a while. With the Dodgers, if you don't win this now, you know, if Clayton Kershaw has kind of a postseason, or you don't win this now, you've got to look at making some moves there, because it's not a. I mean, you just have to.
I mean, I got into a debate with a couple of people when I was in Los Angeles earlier this year, because I think that we sometimes, when evaluating baseball players in particular, put too much emphasis on whether or not a guy came through in the postseason or not, because it's just such a small sample within such a big body of work. I feel like you can't overweigh it. At least do that fairly. But Clayton Kershaw may have, you know, if the Dodgers are the team, Clayton Kershaw's the guy with the most at stake. You know, I mean, he's had a number of opportunities. He hasn't been able to deliver in the big moment. You know, the memories of the 17 World Series against Houston, I mean, that'll linger for a while. And if he's able to just put it up, do what David Price did last year. You know,
exactly
David Price was the guy last year who had the most writing on it. Yeah. Clayton Kershaw's that this year.
Doesn't it at least to one thing, Jeff, about the Dodgers? And I hear what you're saying about, like, will they have to sort of readjust or figure out what they are? Like, the thing about that division just seems like so winnable every year. I know the Giants had their run, and maybe the Padres are eventually going to be good, but the Dodgers have such financial capital, and people want to play there because it's Los Angeles and it's historic. It just seems like the Yankees, they're always going to be like around, even if they don't win a World Series.
And they're smart now. Their farm system turns out players.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I mean, they have arguably the best GM in baseball, and Andrew Friedman.
But it's funny you guys talk about their legacy and what's at stake. But I mean, is there going to be any shame if the Dodgers get to the World Series and lose to Houston?
Yeah.
Is there going to be any shame?
No, I think it's going to be tough, not shame. Though,
I think I think it would be almost worse for them to get to the. This is going to sound odd. For them to get to the World Series and lose would be worse than for them to get eliminated in the National League Championship Series. I think doesn't sound right, but I think you know what I mean.
It would be more tortuous for them.
For the fans.
Yes,
yeah, for sure.
Not exercising those past demons and just living out the
yeah.
But I think, I mean, again, just on the eye test, I think the Astros are better than the Dodgers. I think they would win that series.
I don't know how they're not the favorite. I don't know how they couldn't be considered.
Are the Dodgers
favorite.
The Vegas favorite or are the Astros the favorite? Do we know?
Maybe
because they have to face the Yankees or Twins. That's a tougher road than the Braves Cardinals.
They certainly have the easier road. I mean, the Dodgers, if they don't get through, it would be a stunner. I could see the Yankees. I could see the Rays
same
potentially
with
knocking them off.
It's not crazy. I think that's probably the reason in terms of like so the odds on favorites or not.
We've got 4 minutes left. The NHL, this is the first weekend of NHL action this year. We will see Montreal against Toronto on Hockey Night in Canada tomorrow night. The Leafs, of course, playing the Columbus Blue Jackets on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. They'll be on as soon as we're done here. Again, we've only got 4 minutes. David, I'll start with you, though. You go around and look at the Canadian teams. I'll ask the same question. Which Canadian team is under the gun this year?
Oh, my God. They're all in some respects under the gun.
Ottawa.
When you say under that, you mean like not living up to expectations?
Yeah.
Okay, well, then Ottawa's not part of it because there are no expectations. Edmonton, there aren't really expectations. I guess you'd have to say probably Toronto. I think Winnipeg is in a dire situation because they were so close, and it looks like that Stanley Cup window maybe has evaporated with the state of their blue line right now and certainly Dustin Byfuglien's pending, possible retirement. But Toronto, there's a lot of pressure there. There's a lot of expectations there. They have not won a playoff series with this group of guys. So there's expectations not just to have a good regular season, but to make some noise throughout the playoffs. So I think nothing's acceptable except finding themselves in the final eight, final four, final two. So maybe it's a local answer, and maybe fans in Calgary would feel differently, but I think of the seven Canadian teams, Toronto would be facing the most pressure.
Do you like Vancouver's chances of sneaking in the playoffs? Are
you
one of I'm kind of falling in that way too.
They're my team that I picked as best possible chance to exceed expectations. I really like what Jim Benning's done. He has that great young nucleus, and he's added a bunch of pretty good veterans that have come from winning cultures. JT Miller from Tampa. And
Tyler Myers
from Winnipeg.
Pickup.
Michael Ferland went to the conference final with Carolina. I think he's added the right parts. I like Markstrom as a goalie. I like Travis Green as a coach. And I look at them as a team that could surprise, especially in that division. It's a weaker division, right? So I do think Vancouver, I think they're a playoff team.
Go ahead, Sean.
I was just curious, Dave, how much of a swing if the Winnipeg Jets could figure out what's going on with Dustin Byfuglien? How much does that change things?
Well, he's a difference maker. He controls the ice. I mean, he has such physical presence. And they used to be a big, strong, physically imposing blue line with Trouba, Myers, Byfuglien. And now you look at them, and those guys are gone. Sherratt's gone. Tobias Enstrom, who's a little guy but was a good puck-moving defenseman, he's gone. They only have Josh Morrissey left from that from that Stanley Cup from the conference final run 2 years ago. So Byfuglien, to answer your question, in my opinion, even at age 34, when he's healthy, is a difference maker.
Montreal is in town tomorrow night. We mentioned that. They've got a lot of depth. I think they lack that key. They lack that one guy, though, don't they, Dave? Carey Price is a guy. But in terms of forwards, they don't have an Austin Matthews or a Patrice Bergeron or a Stamkos or Kucherov.
Yeah, their forward depth and their star power up front is their biggest question. When you have Shea Weber and when you have Carey Price and they're healthy, you have a great foundation to be a playoff team. But you're asking a lot of guys like Gallagher to have to get into those tough places and score another 30 goals. They've lost Andrew Shaw. I heard, Ren on here earlier. I'm concerned. You're asking a lot of Nick Suzuki, who's unproven track record, and Kakaniemi, who's in his sophomore. You're asking a lot of these guys to produce. Jonathan Drouin's track record's not great. So Montreal, if Price has an MVP year, that can go as far as he can take them.
Gentlemen, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Awesome.
Penultimate.
The penultimate. So does that make the final one the ultimate?
I get that's TBD. That's to be determined, depending on the quality of the show.
Dylan Brown says it depends who's on. You guys, great minds. Great minds think alike. Great minds think alike there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks to Shai Show. Davide. Show filling in is our producer.
David
today.
Amber. Show Ali filling in is our producer.
Great job.
And Ren Lavoie for joining us in studio. It's always nice to put a face to the voice, a face to the name. I mean,
I seriously can listen to that. He has a great voice.
He's the goalie whisperer. That's what I call
him.
The goalie
I can listen
whisperer.
To that guy all day.
Yeah. He is a great insider, knows a ton about the game.
Awesome.
Yes, he does. For all of us here, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. Don't forget, Leafs Blue Jackets right around the corner. Tons of baseball on the network as well. Have a great weekend, everybody.